You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to the Brookings Institution. I'm John Allen, and I'm the president of Brookings. And I have the honor of opening today's Asia Transnational Threats Forum, the third of its kind, and the topic today is climate change in Asia. With climate change and global warming proceeding at an unprecedented rate, it's more important than ever to understand the climate security nexus, namely how climate change impacting lives and how it is shaping the security and strategic environment of Asia Pacific. This region, with its extensive coastlines, densely populated cities, and small island states, has suffered greater human and economic costs from climate disasters than any other region, and is very exposed to climate-related threats. Asia's coastal megacities and their growing populations are vulnerable to massive population displacement. That, coupled with the growing challenges of urbanization, regional security, insecurity, and inadequate responses and mitigation, climate change has the potential to significantly increase political instability and create security challenges. Severe droughts and loss of arable land can adversely affect economic activity, people's livelihoods, and food security as well. And in fact, this is already taking place. Furthermore, heightened competition for water and scarce natural resources is likely to compound violence and armed conflicts in the future. And in our military, in the United States military, we're already talking about the advent of resource wars. The sense of urgency to respond and to adapt to climate crises is shared by the vast majority of the global community. The European Parliament declared a climate emergency just last month, and last week the EU Commission adopted the European Green Deal. Nagano Prefecture in Japan has recently become the first state in East Asia to declare a climate emergency and promised to take action to address climate change. These are stories of success. What does climate leadership look like today in Asia more broadly, and how are the United States and its Asia-Pacific allies and partners responding to these climate-related challenges? Today we'll seek to answer some of these questions and to take a closer look at the region's vulnerabilities to climate-related threats and the actions that can and should be taken to manage and to mitigate and to respond to these challenges. We have a distinguished lineup of experts from the region to help us to discuss these challenges and these response measures. In particular, we're really deeply honored to have with us today Undersecretary General of the United Nations, Mrs. Otoi Kamanu, who will be delivering the keynote address. And, Madam, you are most welcome here today at Brookings. And I look forward to hearing her remarks and the insightful and thought-provoking discussions that we'll have today in the aftermath. And finally, I'd like to extend my gratitude to the Korea Foundation for its support in making this conference possible. Very important work by a very important organization. Let me now turn the floor over to Jung Park, our senior fellow and the SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies, to begin today's programming. And thank you for coming today.
Thank you, John, for that fantastic introduction. But it's also really hard to do public speaking after a general has gone, given he has a more authoritative, masterful delivery. So thank you, John, for joining us today. I know that this is one of your priorities and this is one of Brookings' priorities. And thanks again to the Korea Foundation for making this happen and letting me not talk just about North Korea-related issues. So one of the best parts of my job is traveling and meeting people from different parts of the world. Last week, I was in Anchorage, Alaska, and it was my first time there, to deliver a talk on North Korea. The people in Anchorage are very nervous because they see themselves as a likely threat or target for North Korean ballistic missiles, which are they're the closest to North Korea from the U.S. perspective. So I packed my warmest and bulkiest winter coat, my winter boots, and a long scarf that I can wrap around my neck 5 times. Ladies, I know you know what I'm talking about. And I was expecting below freezing temperatures and slogging through deep plush piles of snow. Instead, it was 40-something degrees, and there wasn't much fluffy snow on the ground, just fully plowed, very walkable sidewalks. So walkable that I didn't see very many boots like mine, but people were wearing high heels. And the sidewalks, if they were covered, they had some days-old packed ice, a thin layer of days-old packed ice. Yesterday, Anchorage reached a high of 45 degrees, breaking a 30-year-plus record. Villages in Alaska have already relocated at least once and will have to move again. That is, if they have the funds and the means to do so. Residents are worried about fishing and food supplies if the fish migrate for cooler waters. Civic leaders are worried about the erosion of permafrost and damages to infrastructure and how they would pay for it. They're also worried about the melting Arctic and what that might mean for resource competition, especially with China and Russia. One scientist said that it's not climate change, but climate changed. So it was an Anchorage to talk about North Korea, but it also served for me as a stark reminder of how much the present and future of the U.S. is intricately linked with Asia, and how climate and the Arctic, and how climate change is requiring new frameworks on how we think about security and the necessity of immediate action. And new research has shown, as reported by the New York Times, has shown that 150 million people living on land will be below high tide by 2050, and that South Vietnam might be completely submerged underwater. Given the urgency, I am thrilled to have Ambassador and the Undersecretary General Utoika Manu as our keynote speaker. Ms. Utoika Manu, a Tongan national, took up her appointment as the High Representative for the Least Developed Countries, Landlocked Developing Countries, and Small Island Developing States back in May of 2017. Prior to taking up her position with the United Nations, she was the Chief Executive Officer of the Ministry of Tourism in Tonga. As the representative for countries most vulnerable to the climate emergency, especially the 38 small island developing states, Ambassador Utoika Manu has been at the forefront of climate leadership, advocating for expanded efforts to understand and respond to growing climate-related security risks. She has been driving efforts to help countries and multilateral organizations develop better frameworks to tackle the crisis and expanding opportunities for collaboration. And I so welcome Ambassador Utoika Manu to the podium to deliver her keynote.
Thank you, Mr. John Allen, President of the Brookings Institution, Dr. Jung Park, Senior Fellow, Excellencies, distinguished colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. I'm honored to deliver the keynote address at this important event. I would like to express my sincere thanks to the Brookings Institution for inviting me to make this address. The issue of climate change and sea level rise has been a concern to small island developing states for more than 3 decades. A call for action was made in 1994 at the first global conference on the sustainable development of the small island states, and climate change and sea level rise were subsequently incorporated into the Barbados Plan of Action. Research and findings of the impact of climate change are now more prolific than in the 1990s. This prediction was clearly reflected in the language used in the PPOA, and I quote, global climate change may damage coral reefs, alter the distribution of zones of upwelling, and affected both subsistence and commercial fisheries. It may affect vegetation and saline intrusion, may adversely affect freshwater resources. The increased frequency and intensity of storm events that may result from climate change will also have profound effects on both the economies and the environment of SIDS. I've just returned from the 25th Climate Change Conference of Parties held in Madrid. At the opening of the conference, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres observed that the human species has been at war with the planet. Now the planet is fighting back. Climate change has escalated into a global climate emergency. The UN Environment Program 2019 Emission Gap Report finds that we are on the brink of missing the opportunity to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. To limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we must collectively reduce emissions by 7.6% every year between 2020 and 2030. Based on today's commitments by governments, emissions are on track to reach 56 gigaton CO2 equivalent by 2030, which is over twice what they should be. The World Meteorological Organization's 2019 statement on the state of the global climate found that we are hitting new highs on key global warming indicators. Global atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases reached record levels in 2018, with carbon dioxide reaching 147% of pre-industrial levels. 2019 is likely to be the second or third warmest year on record. The past 5 years are now almost certain to be the five warmest years on record, and the past decade, 2010 to 2019, to be the warmest decade on record. In the fall of 2019, the global mean sea level reached its highest value since our earlier precise measurement. The World Meteorological Organization also reported that in September and October, we have seen record low sea ice both in the Arctic and Antarctic. In the first half of 2019, more than 10 million new internal displacements were recorded. 7 million of these were triggered by hydrometeorological events such as Cyclone Idai. Idai was one of the strongest known cyclones to make landfall on the east coast of Africa. It had a devastating impact on several countries, including Mozambique, as well as Malawi and Zimbabwe, landlocked developing countries, which now, up to now, had been spared from the impact of cyclones and hurricanes. At the end of August, Hurricane Dorian wreaked unprecedented damage in the Bahamas to the thousands of homes, infrastructure, and water resources, not to mention the loss of lives, wounded, and numerous people who are still unaccounted for. Initial damages were estimated at US $3.4 billion, equal to one-fourth of the nation's GDP. It was the second strongest Atlantic storm on record and the worst ever to strike the Bahamas. Dorian became the latest in now familiar pattern of devastating extreme weather events. Cyclone Pam, a Category 5 hurricane, struck Vanuatu in 2015. It is considered the worst natural disaster in the history of Vanuatu, with damages estimated at $692 million, equivalent to 64% of GDP. I was in Fiji in 2016 when the most intense cyclone in the Southern Hemisphere on record, Cyclone Winston, hit the Fiji Islands. 44 fatalities with damages estimated at $1.4 billion equivalent to 33% of GDP, was also the costliest cyclone in the South Pacific basin. In February last year, Cyclone Gita, also Category 5, struck my own native country of Tonga, with damages equivalent to 38% of GDP. The impacts of climate change are being felt across the globe. My office is responsible for advocacy in favor of the Small Island Developing States, or SIDS, Least Developed Countries, or LDCs, and the Landlocked Developing Countries, or LLDCs. They are among the most vulnerable countries on the planet. They are at the forefront of the impacts of climate change. The LDCs, LLDCs, and SIDS in the Asia-Pacific region exhibit high vulnerability to climate impacts. The landlocked nations of Central Asia, the mountainous Himalayas, the highly exposed coastal LDCs such as Bangladesh, and the Pacific and Indian Ocean SIDS. Their national circumstances and specific constraints place them at the forefront of climate change, yet these countries have made the smallest historical contributions to global warming. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, special report on 1.5 degrees has highlighted the urgency to act now and to take major steps in order to avert catastrophic impacts. At 1.5 degrees Celsius, over 70% of coral reefs will die, but at 2%, virtually all reefs will be lost. The impacts of climate change will affect all nations, but will pose an existential threat to some SIDS. Indeed, SIDS are confronted with profound structural challenges and disadvantages related to their remoteness, small size, low-lying and areas, and risk of submersion, and extreme exposure to the ever more severe impacts of climate change. Responding to these challenges is made more difficult by limited institutional capacity and difficulties in accessing finance and resources, and compounded by a high degree of vulnerability to systemic shocks. The low per capita GNI in LDCs limits their ability to build resilience and respond to disasters. LLDCs are prone to desertification, while mountainous LLDCs suffer also from glacial lake outbursts, landslides, and flooding. All of these three groups of countries, the LDCs, LLDCs, and SIDS, typically are commodity dependent or have narrow economic base, which further increases their overall fragility. High level of indebtedness place constraints on public sector resources available for investments in climate action and the other sustainable development goals. The impact of climate change reduces land availability, imperils food security, and exacerbates water scarcity. The impact of climate change reduces another possible impact is population being displaced or having to be relocated. My office and the International Migration Office launched a report in September titled Climate Change and Migration in Vulnerable Countries, a snapshot of LDCs, LLDCs, and SIDS. The first of 11 recommendations for governments contained in the report is to acknowledge that climate change is a driver of migration, displacement, and planned relocation, and that human mobility can in turn have impacts on the environment. It is well recognized that sustainable development, peace, and security, and the respect of human rights and the rule of law are closely interlinked. And this has been reflected in the 2030 Agenda and its SDGs. Climate change as a threat multiplier has been universally recognized by the international scientific community in the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report, as well as its impact on security. But with the rapidly accelerating impacts of climate change, it is becoming increasingly apparent that climate change is more than a threat multiplier, but a threat in itself. A threat to people, community, and nations, impacting not only on sustainable development, but on peace and security. This message was articulated in the strongest terms at the Pacific Island Forum Leaders Meeting in August in Tuvalu, where I had the honor to represent the UN Secretary General. Pacific leaders adopted the forum communique and the Kainaki 2 declaration for urgent climate change action now. This declaration, as well as the bold declaration adopted at last year's PIFS leaders meeting, places special emphasis on the security risks posed by climate change. Indeed, climate change poses an existential threat to low-lying or atoll sites. Sea level rise causes loss of land, reducing the amount available for agriculture. Ultimately, land loss will cause the disappearance of low-lying countries, which raises fundamental issues of sovereignty, state integrity, and national identity. Disruption to food and water resources can also make countries unviable. The very means of sustenance of island populations are under threat from climate change. For example, saltwater encroachment threatens their fragile and limited freshwater supplies. Global warming also impacts on the critical resources of fisheries, including the tuna, which are also important to Pacific SIDS. There's a growing evidence that increasing ocean temperatures affects nutrients, productivity, abundance, and migratory routes of tuna schools. And while foreign fleets can adapt to such changes, can be far more challenging for domestic fleets that are fishing in their own exclusive economic zones. In SIDS and coastal nations, extreme weather events damage vital infrastructure. Jetties make up an important part of the maritime transport infrastructure. The destruction following a major hurricane or cyclone can take 3 years to rebuild. This poses direct threats to military and defense installations. Ocean acidification, rising sea levels, desertification, water shortages all threaten food security, increase competition for scarce resources, and eventually trigger the involuntary displacement of people. Furthermore, sea level rise causes communities in the Pacific to be relocated to higher ground. In the Solomon Islands, communities have had to abandon their homes in outlying islands to move to larger islands. In Papua New Guinea, they say that this is the first so-called climate refugees situation with relocation of the people in the Cataract Island, and also we've also had relocation in Fiji as well. And such examples pose challenging issues for the government and stakeholders on land tenure and ownership. If not carefully managed, these can cause social tensions and even conflict. International displacement or migration due to climate change impacts can cause new pressures or exacerbate existing ones, including between nations. To manage such challenges, we need to enhance our global governance arrangements through adaptive institutions, legal and policy measures, and call upon the leadership of all nations to act urgently. An issue that is receiving growing attention is the impact of sea level rise on the exclusive economic zones of small island states. The licensing of foreign fishing vessels in EEZs, especially where there's limited domestic capacity to exploit fisheries, bring in significant amounts of much-needed revenue. The international legal regime that grants maritime boundaries, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS, does not explicitly address the question of the impact of sea level rise and how to treat the possible resulting loss in maritime zones from land loss upon which the boundaries are initially determined. several seats have affirmed the permanency of their UNCLOS maritime boundaries, including EEZs in regional agreements and national legislation. Meanwhile, legal discussions are ongoing in the Sixth Committee of the UN General Assembly on whether the freezing of boundaries or maintaining of existing entitlements are permitted by UNCLOS, and if not, how could this be further articulated from a legal standpoint, either by way of a protocol to UNCLOS, an amendment to existing articles, or a UN General Assembly resolution. In the face of accelerating impacts of climate change, with little progress in mitigation of greenhouse gases by major emitters, it is essential that the rights of SIDS should be rapidly safeguarded and clarified, and any legal uncertainties are dispelled. Failure to do so could create international tensions, given the economic implications both of fisheries and exploitation of seabed resources. A broader question arises on what should be done under the UN architecture to address the climate security interlinkages. The topic of climate change and security has been on the United Nations agenda for some time. Unquestionably, there is a strong interlinkage between UN efforts on development, peace and security, and climate change. Efforts to advance on one pillar are linked to progress made on the other. Adverse climate change impacts can set us back on both. I recall when I held the position of permanent representative of Tonga to the United Nations in 2008, the Pacific countries were already discussing the need to bring the topic to the Security Council. I clearly recall the response we received at one of our very first meetings with a number of member states. Why do you want to take this to the Security Council? Do you want the peacekeepers to stop the water from going onto the islands? But we reaffirmed that this issue was important to us. It was a life or death issue. We were not successful in our attempt to place this issue to the attention of the Security Council, but were able to negotiate and submit a draft resolution entitled Climate Change and Its Possible Security Implications, which was adopted by the General Assembly in 2009. In the same year, at its 40th Pacific Island Leaders Meeting, leaders recognize that climate change is a great challenge of our time and adopted the Pacific Call for Climate Action. There has been a resurgence of attention to this question over recent months, including the role played by the Security Council and other organs of the United Nations. In January of this year, the Dominican Republic, under its council presidency for the month, organized an open debate in the Security Council on addressing the impacts of climate-related disasters on international peace and security. The meeting attracted considerable interest. Over 80 member states debated the issue for more than 8 hours. The majority viewed climate change and security as an important issue that needed to be addressed. Several key points were made at the meeting. Firstly, climate change is a concrete and existential threat to humanity, and some developing nations are particularly vulnerable. Mitigating the impacts of climate-related disasters benefits global stability and conflict prevention. Secondly, the entire United Nations system needs to be engaged in climate change, starting with increasing its analytical capabilities to better understand climate fragility risks and formulate evidence-based response strategies. Thirdly, the United Nations Security Council specific role is to work on the security impacts of climate change and is complementary to the mandate and actions of the UNFCCC and other UN bodies. The climate security nexus should feature regularly in the Council and that there should be regular briefings on climate risks and progress made. And fourth, the Small Island Developing States call for the appointment of a UN Secretary General's Special Envoy on Climate Change and Security. However, as back in 2008, a few delegations questioned whether the Security Council engagement was appropriate, citing knowledge gaps and doubts concerning the link between climate change and security. Some argued the Council should focus more on political issues directly relevant to conflicts, given its specific mandate, as opposed to that of the General Assembly and the UNFCCC. Since that meeting, some progress has been made. The United Nations has developed an integrated risk assessment framework to analyze climate-related security risks. It has also set up an informal interagency group of the UN system entities to share information on ongoing work and promote collaboration. At the level of member states, a group of Friends on Climate and Security, which was set up in 2018 and co-chaired by Germany and the Republic of Nauru, has seen its membership grow to more than 40 countries from all of the UN's 5 regional groups. Germany will occupy a non-permanent Security Council seat in 2020 and has already announced that climate change and security will be a priority agenda item, a topic which it had promoted the last time it held the position in July 2011. Thus, there is hope that progress can be made in addressing the climate change, peace, and security nexus, especially as it is related to exacerbating existing conflicts or even tensions arising from increased competition over scarce critical natural resources. Failure to do so will mean a less effective UN response to existing crises, where climate change is a threat multiplier and possible failure to prevent new conflicts from arising due to climate-related stresses. But what of the loss of land and displacement facing SIDS? If climate change remains unchecked, these issues will pose existential threats, the submerging of entire islands, and challenges to sovereignty, state integrity, and national identity. In 2013, parties to the Climate Change Convention established the Warsaw International Mechanism for Loss and Damage to address loss and damage associated with the impacts of climate change, including extreme weather events and slow onset events in developing countries that are particularly vulnerable to the adverse effects of climate change. AOSIS, the Alliance of Small Island States, was a strong proponent of the mechanism, which they had hoped would provide support on risk management, manage financial risks associated with climate-related extreme weather events, and create an international insurance pool to be funded by developed countries to compensate vulnerable developing countries from uninsured loss and damage. There's been no agreement or progress in international climate talks on financial compensation. Work to date under the mechanism has focused on the first two issues. So we are left with the conclusion that there has been no satisfactory solution to the impacts of climate change facing vulnerable nations. Financial and technical support for adaptation has fallen far short of the mark. This will be essential to ensure that vulnerable countries build resilience to the negative impacts of climate change that are already taking place and will only become more intense and frequent. The response to address loss and damage from climate disasters has been in the form of humanitarian aid, which is little more than a Band-Aid solution. countries attending the recent climate change meeting in Madrid did not agree on concrete actions related to slow onset events such as sea level rise, but instead set up an expert group to look at possible options. The climate-related security risks are adding a new dimension to already complex national development challenges. I would like to end by emphasizing that there would be no need to address the climate change security interlinkages if we had been able to put a brake on our greenhouse gas emissions back in the early 1990s, when the international scientific community had first agreed that human beings were disrupting climatic conditions through greenhouse emissions. The message is as clear now as it was then. And I think we have run out of time. We've run out of time long time ago to respond to this. There is a great urgency to arrest greenhouse gas emission and invest heavily in adaptation in the most vulnerable nations. The consequences are already severe, and the unthinkable is on our doorstep. We have run out of time. In fact, we ran out of time many years ago. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Uthukamanu. When we were looking at keynote, who might deliver the keynote today for this conference, we couldn't think of anybody better than Ambassador Uthukamanu, given her long experience and her leadership on these issues. We have just a few minutes for questions, and the ambassador was gracious enough to agree to a couple of questions. I have lots, but I want to make sure that to give people a chance. So, woman in the back and gentleman up front, let's take two questions.
Thank you. I'm Jean Ninh Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. You made a statement clearly that by 2050, South Vietnam will be submerged under the water if we do nothing now. And not only that, all the small islands would be affected. And right now, you say that we need to mitigate the carbon dioxide emissions since 1990. What would you suggest to do now for the people in the U.S., in Vietnam, in China, and in India? There was talking about carbon tax. Do you think that's a good suggestion?
Thank you. Gentleman up front.
Hi, Chris McRae, Norman McRae Foundation. So I've been to Bangladesh 15 times since 2008, and what I've learned from them is basically one question: why don't we make climate change and solutions to climate change and education curriculum, you know, all the way up from third grade? We absolutely don't, and it is interesting that 3 months ago, when there was a Girls Education Summit at Brookings, the education director of UNICEF said this year he's only looking for transformational work. So would it not be possible for you to go over to UNICEF and basically turn... I mean, you know, we have all these summits where people talk to each other, but it doesn't end up as a product which then becomes an education curriculum that teachers...
So your question specifically is about why don't we have it as part of educational curricula?
Wouldn't that be a more effective way of achieving things than spending all the money on talks and having no money that goes to education?
Thank you. So two questions. One is, what should we do now? What's the you talked about the urgency. What do we need to do now by India, U.S., China, and there was somebody else? And South Vietnam. About Vietnam. And secondly, what are your thoughts about having an educational curriculum to talk about and to be able to, so that we can speak the same language, I guess, right, on climate change and the relationship to security?
Well, thank you for those questions. I think what is important to appreciate is that the climate change and impacts is a global issue, and therefore the response, appropriate response to it, will have to be undertaken at a global level, and the intergovernmental process that has been taking place in Madrid at a COP and others, it will, you know, include political commitments by all countries concerned, the developing countries as well as the developed countries, to limit to 1.5 degrees Celsius. I think that is quite an important political commitment, and then you know, and then others follow through with the operationalization of that and its impact on policies and other decisions in government. With regards to the curriculum, I know that in the part of the region that I come from in the Pacific, climate change is part of the curriculum, so that children at a young age know what the issues are and how they can contribute to mitigating the negative impacts of climate change.
But the problem is that there's a tension between the least developed states and the most developed states, right? And that these the countries that you represent at the
yes.
UN, they're the most vulnerable and also the least developed, which is a mutually reinforcing, debilitating, right, convergence of
yes.
issues?
Well, for the most vulnerable groups of countries that I work across, the least developed, landlocked and small island, 91 states, they're at the forefront of the impact of climate change, and they contribute the least towards the issue. But also they because of their country situation, they don't have the means to really deal with the impacts. I guess the part of the tension is the responsibility for providing the finance to deal with the impacts of climate change, whether it's mitigation or in adaptation.
How much did you feel the U.S. absence in Madrid?
High level
absence.
Well, I was not part. The UN is not part of the intergovernmental process, so we were not in the room in the negotiations. But we were. I was there to support. Particularly the least developed countries and the small island developing states. So my part was focusing on how we can progress on the loss and damage, and then also how we can provide support to these countries in drawing and submitting the NDC report, which is due next year.
Thank you. I'll take one more question over here. Gentleman with the glasses in the fourth row.
Hi, I'm Fernando Batista, formerly World Bank Global Environment Department. And I have a question about the Marshall Islands. And the reason, I'd like to just find out why you didn't put in your security paradigm why the problem with Ruined Island is not mentioned. Because that is, you know, that's the cap where the concrete cap is covering the radioactive material that the United States buried into the ground in the actually 60s, 70s. And I don't know if you could give us a little light on that.
Why the ambassador didn't mention the Marshall Islands?
And the dome, mm-hmm. the concrete cap that
Well, that would be a security issue, wouldn't it? Do you represent the national?
Yes. I'm from the Pacific, and having worked in the government for almost 30 years, we have been involved in considering the Marshall Islands situation, and I've also had bilateral talks with the president of the Marshall Islands on how the United Nations can support them with this particular issue, and so the relevant agencies in the UN are helping the Marshall Islands in looking at analysis and evaluation of the situation with the domes.
Thank you. Thanks all of you for your questions. And please join me in thanking Ambassador Utoikamanu for her wonderful keynote address. We have Annika Betancourt, who is a visiting fellow here, who will be moderating our first panel. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Annika Betancourt. I'm a visiting fellow with the Center for East Asia Policy. It's my pleasure to be with you today. I'm joined by four very distinguished panelists. Immediately to my left is Dr. Melly Caballero Anthony. She's a professor of international relations at the Nanyang Technological University in Singapore and an expert on non-traditional security threats. Thank you for being with us. Next to her is Dr. Soyoung Chung, who's a professor and director of the Center for Global Climate and Marine Governance at Korea University in Seoul. He's also advises the government of the Republic of Korea and came to Brookings directly from COP25 in Madrid, so we're glad to have him. Also joined by Dr. Leonardo Martinez-Diaz, who is currently the global director of the Sustainable Finance Center at the World Resource Institute, and a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Energy and Environment. Thank you for being with us. Finally, last but not least, certainly, is Sherry Goodman, who is a Senior Fellow at the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program and Polar Institute. Also, she was a former First Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Environmental Security, and we're very delighted to have her with us today. Just to start us off, one of the reasons why we wanted to hold this forum was to talk about, as Jung said, climate changed. And so the Asia Pacific is regularly identified as one of the regions that is already hardest hit by the effects of climate change. And obviously these effects carry very important regional and global implications. So I wanted to just give a couple of short data points before we start with our panelists to just give you a snapshot of the situation in the region. So for instance, Southeast Asia is one of the fastest growing economic regions in the world. Growing population urbanization suggests that electricity demand is expected to triple between 2015 and 2040. Just a couple of countries in the region. 70% of Vietnam's population lives along its 2,000 meter coastline. And Indonesia has a population of 264 million and one of the world's longest coastlines of 34,000 miles. In the Philippines, 22,000 mile long coastline and 100 million people. And just for reference, you know, Vietnam, Indonesia, Philippines are somewhere about $2,000 to $3,000 GDP per capita. And as a frame of reference, the ROK's GDP per capita is around $30,000 US dollars, and Australia is $53,000. The number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes have increased by 75% or more since 1970 in this region, as well as the increase in the destructiveness. So it's just a couple of data points. I'd like to turn it over to each of my colleagues here to give some initial comments, and then we'll come back and ask some questions and get some questions from the audience. Let's start with Sherry.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be here with you. I'm going to let you tee up the slides here. So I'm Sherry Goodman, and it's great to be here at Brookings with you all. Let me thank the great Brookings team, General Allen, Young, Annika, the whole team here. Ambassador, very nice to have you here. Korea Foundation, thank you, obviously, for your support. I was really interested. First, let me say, I always start with the bluff, the bottom line up front, right? I spent a lot of time in the Department of Defense with our military, and I'm so pleased that you used the phrase that I coined now 13 years ago, almost threat multiplier, with the first group of military leaders. I would put General Allen, who was on active duty at the time we formed the Military Advisory Board in 2007, but among the cohort of like-minded leaders, first U.S., but now international, who understand the seriousness of the climate threat and characterize it as a threat multiplier. Indeed, you know, when we issued our first report in 2007, right after that, Ambassador, came the first U.N. Security Council report, discussion about climate change as a security issue, and that has led to many of the actions that you have documented since then. Of course, that is, of course, not enough. So, you know, my second bluff is that Asia is on the front line of climate threats globally. And that's why I think this conference is really important. And then third, you know, what can we do about it? And that's improved predictive capabilities and climate-proofing solutions. Now, let's see. What do I need to do here? I don't have – my slides are not as good as yours, Ambassador, so I – you know. But you really told a lot of the story, but I want to start – you know the major issues facing the region. We've already talked about those. I want to put this in some historical context. You showed a slide, Madam Ambassador, from back to 1994, the first U.N. Security Council debate. Well, in 1995 – I held the first Asia-Pacific Environmental Security Forum with then PACOM Commander Admiral Preer. Some of you might remember him going back way back then. He was our Pacific Area Commander. And so our military, the United States military, has a long history of engagement in the region on environmental issues. We didn't frame it as climate change then. We weren't quite that smart. But we were working on a range of issues having to do with water, energy, natural resources protection, cleaning up contaminated sites across the region, and generally elevating discussion and opportunities better to integrate institutions, the military with its foreign ministries, with its environmental ministries, with its finance ministries, across a range of countries and domains. And so now, fast forward, these are the major issues, you know, facing the region today. And it's all framed in this administration, framed by sort of East, you know, great power competition. But underlying and driving a lot of that is the food and water insecurity and, of course, the disaster risk. So, you know, now what we see is the sea level rise being a major source of threat in the region, flooding, rising sea surface temperatures, ocean acidification. And then changing climate circulation patterns, I think, is really important. We're beginning to understand more about that, but I think there's still a lot we don't know about the El Nino and La Nina cycles, how they affect that. But our ability better to understand that will enable us in the future to have better predictive capabilities in the region. Okay, it's no, we sometimes refer to as Disaster Alley. So in the region, disaster risks are rising, and that makes people more vulnerable because they're increasingly exposed to these hazards. And this is a sort of way of framing that hazard's exposure and vulnerability and the impacts. And we see those rising, you know, globally, but especially in the Asia-Pacific region. So we now have 4 out of 5 people affected by natural disasters live in Asia. And you could see that the percent of the world's total, many of them are in the Asia-Pacific region. And your slides, Madam Ambassador, showed that in a very vivid and important way. One thing we should not underestimate is the impact on global food and fish stocks of climate threats. Ocean acidification, rising temperatures, migration of fish stocks, and now, you know, newer findings that the availability of key omega-3 fatty acids could be declining with the changes in ocean temperature. And this is, as you see, this chart shows you various RCP scenarios and the effect on global fish stocks. Not to forget the migration northward of many of the global fish stocks towards the poles. Last week, I testified before in the Senate on the Arctic. And, of course, we have a central fishing moratorium today in the central Arctic Ocean. But many wonder whether China's interest in the Arctic is in part motivated by the future prize of a vibrant fishery in that region. So we see this is going to have global impacts in many ways, and that just exacerbates the challenges for our Coast Guard friends. I saw some of them here at lunch who have the mandate, along with others around the world, to address illegal and unregulated fishing. Okay, well, this is just a snapshot, a bit of an eye chart of the climate hotspots across the region. Some of you probably seen this slide before, but it shows you that there's no lack of challenges across the region. So at the Wilson Center, one of the places where I now am, along with the Center for Climate Security, over the last couple of years, we've been running an effort to improve our predictive capabilities for disruptive weather and water and climate security events by integrating sort of our understanding of the natural system changes, the ecosystem changes, along with transnational threats and security threats, and to get a more integrated framework. And we've done 4 case studies now. I'll talk briefly about 2. We did 1 on South Asia and Pakistan, looking at the climate threats there. And you can see how in this part of the region, you have a lot of climate insecurities, got a lot of drought combined with flooding, Himalayas, the water tower of Asia. As that changes, that's going to make many more people water insecure across the region. And you see some now new elevation data. I'm going to show you a little bit more in a moment about how Mumbai, just as an example, a megacity, could be very much underwater in coming years. Now, we recently took a deeper dive into the COFA states. Somebody asked about the COFA states here in the Asia-Pacific region, the Marshall Islands, along with Federated States of Micronesia, to look at a combined set of threats in this region, both the increasing presence of China in the region, but also and the COFA states, our arrangements with the COFA states come up for negotiations within the coming years. And what are their major challenges? Many of them food and water insecurity driven by climate change. And how can we better shape our engagements? We did this with Indo-PACOM, J9, as well as NOAA and other U.S. federal agencies, and looking at this integrated set of risks. So here you see the A2AD outer island chain and a combined set of risks. We're trying to better combine and at the same time disaggregate these complex compounding risks in the region. And we just need to underscore, I think, that migration and climate migration, and Ambassador, you said it very well, this region is going to be at the front line of a new generation of climate migration, and we don't currently today have the legal mechanisms to address it, to address the sovereignty of nations, of people who will be displaced, and to manage that. And that is one deeply personal to me. My parents were Holocaust refugees, and they were fortunate enough to come here and to be able to live their lives. And many of the legal mechanisms we have in place here today are those that we put in place after World War II to deal with the refugee crisis as we understood it at the time. And we need to really think about how we update that. And I was very interested in the solutions that you put forward there, Madam Ambassador. I'm going to move right on to this next set because I know my time is running out, but I think this new elevation data that's come out is important for people who are working in this space to know about. And I have to thank Climate Central and my colleagues over there. This shows you this new data, the increased number of people that are going to be at risk from annual floods in a number of countries across the Asia-Pacific region, and the numbers are quite significant, the increased exposure to many cities, many key populated cities in the region. And just as an example, land below the projected flood level in 2050 in Bangkok, Thailand, with this new data, you see many, many cities much more at risk. And if you want to take a deeper dive into it, you could go and look at all this, these data sources. That's where it comes from. And with that, I'm going to get off the stage and look forward to engaging with you in the Q&A session.
We'll go with Leonardo.
I'll do it from here. That's all right. Thank you for taking on this issue. It is absolutely crucial, and the connections between climate change and security are now becoming more and more clear. I think after Sherry's excellent presentation, you will begin to feel a bit overwhelmed, and that's always the impression one feels after just even a casual survey of the compounding damages and the risks. And so one of the crucial things we need to do, both as policy students, policymakers, and as a general public, is to figure out how do we come up with a positive, concrete agenda for action that, of course, that includes cutting emissions, because there is no adapting to a five-degree world and probably even not to a three-degree world. But we have to come up with, as we cut emissions, we also have to come up with ways to begin to absorb, reduce, and bounce from the damage, bounce back from the damage. And that means thinking more deeply about a policy agenda for building resilience. And that's what my co-author Alice Hill and I do in a recent book, Building a Resilient Tomorrow. We lay out 10 lessons that we have learned so far on how to build resilience. The focus is on the United States, but I think those lessons are easily exportable to other parts of the world. Let me give you just a flavor of a couple of those lessons that build on very much the agenda that Sherry just set out. The first is about building more resiliently around the world. This is especially important in Asia, which has, of course, some of the largest cities and urban environments in the world. And I think this lesson is about how do we build more smartly, and how do we build for the future, not just the past. It's pretty clear now that the future will not resemble the past in terms of climate, in terms of all the parameters that we currently use to design, site, and build infrastructure. And so now we have to begin to think about what are these structures going to be withstanding? Where do we place them so they will be at lower risk? And how do we make sure that this applies not just to, you know, key military and political facilities, but that they also include the vast majority of commercial and residential structures that are the heart of the economy in most places. So what this means is we need, first of all, a land use policy, building codes, and zoning regulations that set up a clear boundary about where not to go, right? Where are the safe zones? Where are the unsafe areas? We need to broadcast to the public, to developers, to real estate, the real estate community, to villages and cities about the importance of planning in a way that is future informed. And that means governments have to come up with flood maps, they have to come up with risk maps, and to develop a hazard matrix that allows all of these different decision makers across the economy to make good decisions about where to build. And we need to have building codes that are enforced, not only that they're good, but also enforced. The story of Houston, I think, is informative. The city of Houston in Texas, of course, had a policy of pretty lax building codes. It allowed folks to build pretty much wherever they wanted. And over time, you had a vast city that was very dynamic economically. But then when Hurricane Harvey arrived in 2017, it dumped 50 inches of rain in just a few hours, causing massive flooding and enormous damage. Very shortly after that, the city got together and passed some of the most stringent building codes in the United States. And whether they will be enforced and how they will be enforced remains to be seen. But it's clear that cities, even those that before were not embracing strong building codes, are beginning to do so. And in Asia, of course, the systems in every country, every city are different because of the politics and the governance and the history. But the overall message here is clear. We have to build for the future. The second lesson that I want to leave you with is about data. We need to get the data, but we need to make it usable. Today, we collect more climate and weather data than we ever have in the history of humanity, right? Just NOAA alone collects terabytes of data, enough to fill over 7,000 90-minute Netflix videos a day, right? And that's just one agency. And so the problem isn't so much collecting more. We will continue to do that. The problem is how do you boil that down and turn it into decision-ready data that folks can use in businesses, in cities, in communities. And that means not just getting the right data to the right folks. It means doing so in an interface that doesn't require a PhD to understand, right? And that's true in Vietnam as it is in the United States. We still have not cracked that yet. There were, during the Obama administration, I recall, lots of efforts to try to increase access to data, lots of clearinghouses and places, platforms online to get the data. But in the end, it can be quite overwhelming, especially if you're working in a small city or in a small business with limited resources. So we need to be able to do that. There's some excellent technological capacity now that can help us do that, but we need the political will to build these interfaces and to ensure that the cost of these of the data is accessible. Of course, the private sector will create very fancy proprietary tools for big business to understand what's happening to its supply chains and so on, but we need to make sure there's a platform of accessible, free or very low-cost data that people can use. Third lesson, really quickly, is about finance. We need to make markets work for resilience. And that means we need to make sure that prices begin to capture climate risk. And currently, they're not really doing so. In real estate, we're beginning to see a signal, a price signal, in places like Florida, like New York. We've detected now a price differential between 6 and 7% of discount that properties in risky areas appear to be incurring in the market. But stocks and bonds, insurance premiums, all of these things do not yet fully reflect the magnitude of the risk. And that is true in the United States, as it is true in many parts of the world that have even less well-functioning markets. So we need to figure out, in those places where the markets are already quite sophisticated and deep, how do we ensure that climate risk is increasingly reflected? And that is, of course, quite important because it then drives, the prices then begin to drive decisions to buy and sell insurance and bonds and stocks and real estate. And that, of course, leads over time to reward those players that are building resilience and to signal to others that this is dangerous, right? And you probably shouldn't be buying that property or shouldn't be investing in that company. Finally, Sherry already alluded to this, is the real pickle of relocation. How do you resettle people, not just individuals in individual households, from one place to another, but how do you move communities, entire communities, to other places? There are places that are worth protecting, where you can build more seawalls, more mangroves, more infrastructure to protect the assets, but then there are places that simply will not be economically feasible to protect. And the question is, how do we do that? And how do we do it gradually with plenty of time, with preparation, so that the relocation, which is inherently going to be traumatic, is not the kind of human tragedy that we saw in Katrina, in New Orleans during Katrina, in the Philippines during Typhoon Haiyan, right? And that means there are some experiments already in the United States. We've seen this done in Louisiana in a small scale, in Alaska. So far, moving whole villages is enormously expensive. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars per person. And so until we're able to reduce those costs and figure out more efficient ways to do this, it's going to be quite difficult. We do have in the United States a buyout program that allows the government to individually sort of buy people's homes and allow them to relocate. But that is very very slow. And in many places, folks don't want to leave. They are naturally attached by history, by culture to a place, and they will not take the buyout. So we need to think of more community-oriented ways to convince folks that moving as a group is a logical thing. Politically, this will mean that we need politicians all the way to the local level who are willing to engage communities in a dialogue about this issue. And the earlier, the better.
Thank you. Dr. Chang?
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to Brookings. I was flying from Madrid. Actually, I couldn't see the final moment of the climate change meeting because of my travel scheduled here. Even if we were expecting to seal the final deal in Madrid, but actually things have been postponed to Glasgow next year. And then that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a hopeless thing, but I think we are just taking some moments actually to find out a better solution. So no deal is better than no action. So that's the moment motto that we found in Madrid. By the way, this is my second coming to Washington, D.C. In a conference on climate change with the support of Korean Foundation. And then today's theme is the Asia Transnational Threat Forum and Climate Security in Asia. So let me ask you one question before I go into the, you know, some of the details. What is the definition of the security in the encyclopedia? If you take a look at it, one of the definition is feeling safe. That's what security means. So what we need to do in Asia Pacific in terms of the climate security is that we have to let people feel safe. So then the question is, how can you do it, right? And then threat means that we don't feel that safe, you know, even by listening to that. And then if I want to make you feel safe, then I need to address the immediate threats, right, measures, so that we can avoid that immediate threats. But that's not enough. You know, we need to ultimately find out the fundamental solutions that will prevent the threats from not happening to us. In this sense, let me just compare the, some of the situation between in the United States and in Asia Pacific by looking at the same impact to the society. I'm sure that everybody in this room still remember 2005 when the Hurricane Katrina hit the United States. Do you know how many people lost lives at the time? About 10 to 2,000 people. It was a great loss. Similar size of the typhoon, it's like you know, a hurricane in Asia, hit Philippines. Do you know how many people lost a life? 12,000 people. With the same impact to the society. But in the United States, you lost a lot, but 12 times more people lost their lives in Philippines. That's my starting point, why Asia Pacific is important. By the way, if you take a look at the study by the scientists about why Asia Pacific is important in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions, more than 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions will come from Asia. That's a lot. And under the UNFCCC, UN rule, climate change rule, do you know what? Up until Paris Agreement was adopted, Kyoto Protocol said only developed countries take the legally binding responsibility to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In Asian context, there are only almost one country belonging to that category, that's Japan. Other than Japan, including Korea, actually, we didn't have to do anything. who is the number one emitter in the world in now? In China, right? And then I'm sure that India will sooner or later replace that seat. And then Korea is number seven. And then we have other countries. But Asia doesn't have any institutional basis actually to address climate change, even if the impact is greater than in the United States. Then question is, I said, what is the fundamental solution that we have to find out, long-term solution, right? Where does that threat come from? That's the human activities, right? And then fundamentally, we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. By the United States only? No. What I'm talking about, Asia is becoming engine of growth of the world, right? China, Korea, Japan, these days Vietnam is booming, and we know next destination is India, and do you want to include the Middle East as well? So it's an engine of growth, not taking any legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And here, if you ask even Korea to me, would you want to take legally binding obligations to reduce greenhouse gas? Of course not. If I think about national interest, right? And you have to design the institutions and governance scheme in Asia actually where players can comfortably follow the rule, thereby reducing greenhouse gas emissions. How to do it? What are needed, right? That's what we need to think about. Number one, going back to Philippines' case, many Asian countries, Asia is very diverse, but many Asian countries lack capability, right? So we need to help them. We are talking about some of the small-eyed countries in Pacific region. They don't have a capacity to cope with these threats and turn it into a matter of the opportunity by growing your economy, introducing low-carbon technologies. So they don't have a capacity. You go to even the Africa, they want to grow their economy, but they don't have a capacity. So we need to have capacity building process. Not in Northeast Asia, though, right? If you go to Japan, we don't have to work on it. We are talking about some part of Asia, right? Number two, as I said, governance matters. Are we talking about only Pacific region or Northeast Asia, South Asia, including Middle East? We don't have forum here, right? Of course, climate is a global problem. That's true. But do you know what the Paris Agreement means, which governs the society now to address climate change? It gives the whole driver to the hands of the individual states by focusing on the implementation, not regulation. Meaning that, asking countries to develop their five-year low-carbon development plan, we call it as a National Determined Contribution, NDC, submitted to UNFCCC every 5 years. We are not going to enforce you to do so. We just review it, encourage you to, constantly implement your growth plan. It's good for everybody. So because it's a matter of implementation by individual countries, there is increasing more opportunities for countries to work together with neighboring countries, right? You go to Northeast Asia, Jung said that we are not going to talk about North Korea today. I have a lot to say in climate context. I have in my mind how two Koreas can be unified only thinking about the climate change. I have good solutions. I'm just waiting for another president candidate to take my idea. Because do you know why? Climate change is a matter of opportunity. Last week in Madrid, North Korean delegation even came and they said they'd like to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And they will do so more if Indonesian society helps them to do so. So it's about the development, okay? But we don't have a governance system at the regional level in place. Of course, thinking about the immediate threat, you need to set up the sort of the regional disaster risk management system and some other things and see the rise, right? That's necessary, but that's not all. You need to have a regional economic development forum, right, which focuses on low-carbon technologies. Do you know what is the size of this at the global level in terms of market size? Some people say 2% of the global GDP. As I said, Asia is engine of the growth of the world. So there is a vast amount of the market potential. Do you know I'm sure that you heard about the Saudi Aramco going to IPO these days. Do you know why? Because they want to transform their energy system from fossil fuel to renewables. To do so, they need to have a bit more financial resources. That's why they decided to open some part of their big company to the world. Everybody is ready, right? And then also, there is another issue that the Asia society needs to think about. That's, is there any governing systems of supporting the financial institutions in Asia? That's another issue. We have AIIB promoted by China. Do you know what is the largest climate change finance organization in the world at this time? That's Green Climate Fund, which is located in Republic of Korea. Do you know have you ever heard about the Global Green Growth Institute? This new intergovernmental organization having the more than 30 countries as members. What is the focus of this organization? It helps developing countries to identify their path of growth in a low carbon way. Right? It is based in Republic of Korea. Why? Because Asia society is so important. Of course, Korea was lucky enough to get some of them, but not because of the Korea, but in general, Asia society has a lot of potentials. Here, my point. Asia society, Asia Pacific has a lot of problems in terms of being exposed to the threats, but depending on how we work together, we can transform this society in a very safe place where everybody feels safe. And then there are a lot of good opportunities, especially United States can work together in Asia. So I stop here. Thank you.
Thank you. And last but not least, Dr. Cavallo-Anthony.
Thank you. The problem with you're the last speaker is most of this, your panelists have already said, I actually have a lot of notes. So, but anyway, before that, really thanks to Brookings for organizing such a timely meeting. and also for giving me the opportunity to join this panel and to tell you more about the Asian story that has already been talked about very often. Dr. Jun talked about how Asia can actually work together. The impact of climate change, as many of you already know, is not just cross-cutting, but it also has this really transnational impact. What happens in one state affects the other. So when you talked about having institutions, governance institutions, and particularly for countries that are really, really facing, directly exposed to many of the climate, the impact of climate change. What you need, therefore, is perhaps apart from understanding what the risk is then to say, so what do you do? We have witnessed the frustration at the international level when countries try to negotiate emission targets. But at the same time, while the negotiation is happening at the global level, there's a realization that you also have to help countries deal with the day-to-day security challenges. So in other words, the adaptation response and the adaptation capability. So what I'd like to do in the very short time allotted to me is to just highlight three key issues, important critical issues in Asia, particularly in Southeast Asia, because as you mentioned, four or five of the countries in Southeast Asia are really in terms of most climate vulnerable. You're talking about Indonesia, you're talking about Vietnam, you're talking about the Philippines, Myanmar. These are all highly exposed. And so when you talk about the impact on displacement, and this is where I refer to my notes, really as just for 2018 alone, the number of people that have been displaced, new displacement in the region is really close to over 6 to 8 million people. five countries of this countries, the new displacement also is not just from natural disasters, but also natural disasters coupled with conflict, existing conflict. So you have in the Philippines, close to 3.9 million people. In Indonesia, 857. In Myanmar, if you just if you don't include the Rohingya population that is also suffering, highly exposed to natural disasters, you also have just conservatively 340,000 people. So what do you do with this new displacement? And how do you deal with the frequency of natural disasters? How can the region help in dealing with search and rescue operations, providing assistance to those that have been affected by natural disasters? So this is shaping the discourse in Southeast Asia. And if we talk about regional cooperation within Southeast Asia, one of the biggest agenda is really to deal with disasters is humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. So apart from ensuring that you are able to get countries to help, providing logistics, for example, getting volunteers out there, but you need to have people that can easily be deployed so that you are able to then have what you call an assessment group. This was very difficult in 2008 when Cyclone Nargis came to affected Myanmar. It was very difficult to bring assistance in. And as a result of that, there's a long story behind it, and I'm sure you know, but as a result of that, the region decided to have a legally binding agreement. The ADMIR, the ASEAN Disaster Management of, Measures for Emergency Response, which allows countries, of course, to then provide immediate assistance. And as a result of that, you have now a mechanism in the region called the AHA Center, the ASEAN Center for Humanitarian Assistance, that can then coordinate assistance to the region. So when Cyclone Typhoon Haiyan happened, despite all the imperfections of this regional mechanism, you were able to send people to come in and to provide assistance to local governments. You're able to send in and coordinate some of the assistance coming from foreign governments. And as this center gets more improved in terms of being able to forecast natural disasters, help provide alert assistance, and at the same time build the capacity of individual countries to have what they call the National Disaster Management Mechanism that meets every year. They share experiences. Then while you cannot prevent disasters from happening, at least you're able to help people respond to the disasters and at least prepare. So you won't have an instance where when you run out of medicine, when you don't have enough food, you don't have enough tents, then, you know, what do you do? The region should be able to provide assistance to a neighbor that has suffered from natural disasters. There are, of course, controversies. How do you deal with countries that are not that don't welcome assistance, immediate assistance, because being able to open your doors to immediate assistance will also expose your own weaknesses. So what happens in the humanitarian assistance and disaster relief exercise is to be able to build confidence and trust, you know, among neighbors that we don't have enough capability and we need help. And it also means telling us from them what needs to be improved. The second is really having to do with the impact of too much water or too little water in terms of food security. Asia is known to be a food basket to many parts of the world, but it also continues to suffer from, as a result of natural disasters, already very real challenges to food resources. In terms of yield, for example, there is a reduction, not just in food stocks, in terms of cereals, and but also in terms of fish stocks. So what do you do? What's happening in the region is try to be able to develop, you're talking about building resilience, to develop what you call climate smart technologies. How do you help countries develop this technology given the fact that production production would be constrained as a result of climate change? Now, It's important to note that climate change, as a result of climate change, you're also seeing a region that for the longest time, you see a lot of millions of young children actually suffering from undernourishment. In East Asia and Pacific alone, the number of undernourished children more than below the age of 5 in the year 2000 was already 23.8 million, and that is expected to rise to another 15 million by the year 2050. If most of your undernourished and hungry people are actually in East Asia, and including, you know, the wider Asia and also in Southeast Asia, can climate smart technologies help? How do you help your farmers being able to address the prospects of lower yields in terms of rice, and which is a main staple in the region? Are you able, therefore, to build, use technology for cities, make cities become your producers of food rather than rely solely on the rural areas? So can cities be given the technology to even grow rice? The discussion in the region, for example, is a small city-state like Singapore, where you have all this public housing. At one point, there were some ideas that you can actually have your, we call it housing, this public housing. On top of it, you can actually build rice fields. That's something to think in the future. Or you make use of vertical gardens to grow your own vegetables. So can a country that imports 90% of its food become at least 20 to 25% independent of food when it comes to, for example, producing their own vegetables or even producing things like eggs or the other ambition is some kind of smart aquaculture. So things like that. It's an opportunity that's out there. It's an opportunity that can be rehashed, at the same time addressing the real challenges of food security. The third is the challenge to health. Southeast Asia has a long history, most recent history of infectious diseases. We suffered from SARS in 2003. We also suffered from the bird flu, H5N1. And there was also the problem with the problem with the MERS virus. And as a result of climate change, many people already know that it will actually increase the incidence of vector-borne diseases. One of the concerns at the moment is what do you do with the transmission of new breed of mosquito diseases such as dengue, chikungunya, and the Zika virus? And how do you minimize or control the possibility of more cases of malaria or even waterborne diseases like cholera? The increase of rural to urban migration, the lack of proper urban architecture to support it, also increases the risk of water supply contamination. So all of these scenarios are being played out. So what do you have? Within the region, as a result of SARS, in fact, the wider region, you now have a body that looks at, a task force that looks at the incidence of pathogenic infectious diseases. What they do is to increase surveillance mechanism. So as a result of SARS, we now have a system where health authorities think about providing a regional, just like a global disease surveillance mechanism, thinking about the possibility of having a regional disease surveillance mechanism. And at the same time, looking at the possibility of having, for example, a bank for vaccines. Now, all these measures were necessary then, but is now even realized to be even more important as people prepare for the impact of climate change. What that tells you, therefore, is while the region is very much vulnerable to the impact of climate change, there are movements that are taking place, institutions that are being developed to respond to climate change. Taking off from what was mentioned earlier, it's being able to understand that while your scientists have all the data, you're able to translate that from knowledge to actual policy and to actual mechanisms, at the same time raising awareness and getting neighbors to actually work together to respond to many of the shared challenges of climate change. For sure, there'll be difficulties. I talked about the problem of having to relocate and having to deal with displaced population. The region has its own share of guilt in not being able to respond, for example, to forced migration in the case of what happened in Myanmar. But now you actually look at the specter of one neighbor, Bangladesh, that is now thinking of relocating many of these refugees in another island that is also prone to natural disasters. And there's been a lot of talk when you talk about the linkage between climate and security about the impact of this more close to a million refugees. At the same time, they could also be possibly climate-induced refugees, and it's basically a double whammy problem for them. So the region is not completely is unprepared, but at the same time trying to do something to address many of these shared challenges. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, great. So I think what we'll do is we'll take a couple of questions from the audience. I also have a couple of questions, but perhaps we have the same questions. So I'll take a couple, and then we'll kind of go down the line and see who would like to answer them. So I saw a hand in the back.
Thank you. My name is Michael Trekim. I have a question for Professor Jiang. You have mentioned the Global Green Growth Institute and the Global Climate Fund. So I'm wondering, what lessons did the Republic of Korea learn from hosting those two institutions? And what do you think those two institutions bring to the table? Or after your COP25 experience, where do you think those two institutions could bring some new solutions?
Okay. There's also a woman here. Third row.
Hi, my name is Karen Florini. I'm the Vice President of Programs at Climate Central. Thanks, Sherry, for highlighting our new study. I just wanted to make the offer to folks who might be interested in that, that the corrected elevation data are now publicly available for free for non-commercial use. And if anyone is interested in following up on that, please let me know. This matters immensely because sea level rise is not just a matter of the height of the water, but also of the height of the land. And as our new study indicates, the widely the most widely used data set available to date has an average error of 6 feet. We've gotten that down to 4 inches. So again, if anyone's interested in following up on those data, I'm happy to discuss afterwards.
Great. There's also a woman here in the fourth row. Yes.
I have a question about the ice melting in the polar region and its influence on international relations in Asia. Not just China, but also our allies, such as South Korea and Japan, are also interested in the Arctic region, especially in the Northern Sea route above Russia, and not natural resources over there in the because of the ice melting in the high north. So it seems that Russia is also welcoming their fans and investments for Russian LNG gas pits construction projects, such as Yamal project. So could you talk about your thoughts about what changes will be brought to the international relations because of the climate change in the high north region?
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to add one question and then we'll go down the line. So looking at and some of you touched on this, the intersection between demography, inequality, and migration. Across the Asia Pacific, you have very highly developed countries, and you have developing countries at various stages of development. And so, with the unequal impacts of climate change across the region, and despite ocean, very mobile and innovative populations, first of all, where do the migrants go? Where is the first, second, third kind of destinations if they predict they're going to be displaced or they have been displaced? And what is the responsibility of the developed countries in the region? And if Dr. Zhang, if our OK government, for instance, has looked at kind of what the government might do in the face of migrants coming from the region, that would be very interesting. So there's that question, and then also lessons learned from the Global Green Growth Institute and what those institutions in the ROK can bring to the table. The woman from Climate Central talking about the height of land versus the, and it was more of an announcement than a question, but we appreciate that. And then the role of Asian nations in ice melting in the polar region. So why don't we start with Sherry? Feel free to pick any and all.
Okay, I'll take the Arctic question. And you could read my testimony before the Senate Commerce Security Subcommittee last week, where I talk about this extensively. So Russia is essentially militarizing and attempting to monetize the Northern Sea Route. Now, with, you know, the sea ice is melting at the Arctic, and the polar regions are melting twice as changing twice as fast as the rest of the planet. You know, we're seeing increasingly navigable waters. It's very, you know, the rapidity of change is well beyond anything that has been documented. The permafrost is now collapsing at a point where it may even become a source of emissions as opposed to a sink in the future. So Russia, with the longest Arctic coastline, first seeks to monetize the opportunity to create a toll road across the Northern Sea Route and in the future have a shipping route that stretches from Shanghai to Hamburg and is available to, you know, for Asian and other shippers who want to both seek the vast energy and other natural resources in the region, but also eventually use it for destination shipping. At the same time, Russia has remilitarized many parts of the Arctic, rebuilding its bases. It's put a lot of nuclear, it's got nuclear-armed nuclear icebreakers. It's developing the first nuclear-armed vessel that will take operation in 2023. So there are a lot of activities occurring there that are deeply concerning from a security standpoint. At the same time, they've been open to a great deal of Chinese and other foreign direct investment to help build out Yamal and other energy opportunities across the region. They need both financing and, in some cases, they need technology. So China has seen this as an opportunity, declared itself a near Arctic stakeholder, is seeking to build a sort of polar silk road that takes advantage of the Northern Sea Route and potentially in the future a Central Arctic route if that should open up in decades hence. Japan and South Korea certainly have, and Singapore and others have already been very much involved in Arctic research. Svalbard, which has a unique international legal status, which allows a sort of centrally a demilitarized island that's part of Norway, which allows for international research. Many of these countries have researchers stationed up there, are seeking to understand how the Arctic is changing so that they could be part of this whole new geostrategic competition that has essentially opened up because of climate change. I would just say on the your last question on changing demographics of the region and how to take advantage of the talent and the diverse talent that exists across the region. One of the things I know that INDOPACOM, and I'm sure General Vole will talk more about this when he comes up here later, is that there's now a law, there's a U.S. law on women, peace, and security, but there's an international mandate on it. And I think there are opportunities in terms of combining engagements on women, peace, and security and on climate security to put those populations most directly affected, which is often women and children, at the front lines of the solution set on climate change across many of the small island and developing states. It's an often untold story because it doesn't fit the current narrative of great power competition, but it's a very important opportunity, and I see, you know, from where I sit and engaging, you know, most directly with our U.S. military that wants to engage not just on the military side, but broader sort of whole of government. And I think there are many ways in which that can be heralded and cultivated and nurtured right now.
To your question on how do we deal with the prospect of millions of people being displaced from coastal areas in Asia and other parts of the world, right? I think you're going to need several things. The first is for governments to have an understanding of where the receiver communities are going to be, the second line of defense, if you will. It's, of course, somewhat speculative, but you need to be able to model where folks are going to go. So we know, for example, that during Hurricane Katrina, 1 million people were displaced from New Orleans and surrounding area. 250,000 wound up in Houston, where they were largely resettled. The other 750,000 went to very many states. And so we need to be able to think through where are those receiver communities going to be, and to begin to prepare them for that eventuality, right? And that means building infrastructure, in many cases, flexible surge capacity, if you will, in education and healthcare, so that they are ready to absorb some of those folks once they come in. In the case of New Orleans, the city of Houston was able to absorb those folks largely without too much trouble because it's a big economy and it was largely undisturbed by the hurricane. But what if it hadn't been Houston? It was a smaller place. What if it had been a city that had also been hit in some way, right? So we need to strengthen the receiver communities starting now. The second is to inject some programs that allow for immediate cash to those who need to make the move, right? So even in the United States, we know that people have a lot of trouble finding even $500 of surplus cash if they needed an emergency. And with renters, we know from surveys that most renters would have trouble coming up with $2,000 to relocate or to move quickly. This is just in the United States, right? In other places, that's even more challenging. So are there programs we can put in place to provide that quick infusion of cash, small grants? In the case of Katrina, again, the government allowed folks to access their retirement or their pension fund money without a penalty, so they could just get that extra couple of $1,000 they needed to move. So are there things we can do to provide that quick assistance? The third is, how do you provide help so that those who are displaced can find a new livelihood and relocate permanently without terrible hardship, right? So these are things like coming up with seamless financial services so that you can carry your financial services, your bank account, your credit card, whatever it is, to a different state or even a different part of the country without having to start from scratch. How do you come up with some licensing requirements for certain professions that allow people to export, to move their skill set from one place to another, again, without having to start from scratch? Essentially, how do you facilitate mobility and reduce the transaction costs of folks who need to start a new life somewhere else? In cases of more low-income communities, as was the case after Haiyan, the Philippine government started to move folks who were fisher folk primarily up to the mountains, right, and quickly realized that they didn't know how to make a livelihood for themselves because they had no skill sets for their new location. So we need to figure out how to train those people and provide the resources necessary to help them make a new living wherever they are going to be located. Bangladesh, by the way, is starting to think of some creative ways with the German government to do that. And finally, on GGGI and the Green Climate Fund, I have a little bit of experience there because I used to represent the U.S. on the board of the Green Climate Fund, and I had to go to Korea three times a year for several years to represent the U.S. And I think what I would say is it's great that Korea took the opportunity to house and host these important institutions in its own country. It's important that it was in Songdo, the new sort of city that came up from nothing into a major, hub. What I'd say is it's important to continue to internationalize that city so you can continue to attract people from all over the world who can stay there, right? It's been difficult for many years because it's been largely a city that has continued to evolve from zero. And now that it's built up, it still needs to be a place where folks can move seamlessly again in terms of financial services, in terms of language, so that it truly becomes an international hub rather than just a Korean city that happens to house these international organizations.
I can continue to have some of the explanation about the GGGI and GCF. Personally, I knew the GGGI before it was formed. So I was a council member of the GGGI, sitting in the governing body, also member of the committee to host the GCF for Republic of Korea. Looking at these two organizations, there are many things that we can learn, especially from the developing countries' point of view. First of all, it tells the countries that climate change is not a matter of the cost, but matter of the opportunities. Taking one country example of Ethiopia that I'm more immediately engaged with, Ethiopia's NDC, and if you don't know the term NDC, it's a National Climate Change Plan, needs to submit to the UNFCCC. It was this organization which actually helped the government of Ethiopia to prepare for this National Climate Change Plan called the Climate Resilient Green Economy, which is very, very ambitious to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 64%. Relative to BAU level in 2003. And then they engaged in the various policy measures with the support of this global organization. And then so it ends up with that the Ethiopian National Plan NDC has become one of the very best NDCs at the UNFCCC level, which helped these countries to get more funding than other African countries from the GCF. And then if we go to Ethiopia, Ethiopia Airlines, for instance, has around 30 Dreamliners. So more than the Korean Air or Asian Airlines in terms of the defined aircrafts, which is very energy efficiency in fuels. Everything is in context of the climate change. They have some ability actually to draw the attention from the society because they interact with the major players at the global level with this organization. And then, by the way, if we go to Addis Ababa, their prime minister who received the Nobel Peace Prize, right? One of the main reasons why he received the Nobel Peace Prize this year is because he planted trees more than anyone else before. So that helped him actually to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. What I'm talking about, because of the political will. And then being associated with a very fine expertise-based services by this organization, actually some poor country has a vision to become middle-income country by 2025. So GGGI has been very much helpful in terms of the helping, working together with the developing countries. They also helped the Fiji, government of Fiji, actually some years ago, 2 years ago, to develop their national plan on how to implement the green growth. And then GCF is also very, very unique, not only because it is a climate change focus in terms of methodology, as you may know, that the private sector is more critical in terms of providing funding to the climate world. And then GCF has this very unique component called private sector facility. In other words, if a major company would like to go to developing country, but you're not sure about the political risk and some other risk so that you can make an investment decision, you'd knock at the door of the GCF. They will match their funding actually to risk this problem so that the private sector can comfortably penetrate into developing countries. Thereby, you can help developing countries to grow their economy, creating jobs, and then the technology transfer happens, and then GCF only has this function. So there are some good lessons that we can learn. With two organizations, they now have more than 300 steps. Both the GGGI and GCF have more 300 steps. They were created in 2012 as a very fast growing organization. There are many good opportunities you can utilize by engaging yourself from these two organizations. So I stop here.
With regard to mobility, it's easy to have all these plans, and I think they're very important to prepare for the real possibility that, as in the context of Asia, but I'm talking about Southeast Asia, that you really have thousands of people going to be displaced as a result of natural disasters. But the problem, however, is that most of the countries are not really prepared to deal with displaced population. You talk about the case in Typhoon Haiyan, for example, but in conflict settings, like in the case of southern Philippines, it's very difficult. And this is where sometimes, while you have all these plans in place to provide, ensure that they have, you have the right relocation, you're able to provide for cash transfers, you have the search capacity to ensure that you have medical personnel and all the other relevant agencies to deal with the needs of displaced population. There is also, at least in the discourses in the region, is that you really have to get the local communities prepared to accept this displaced population. Because most of the time, it cannot just be governments to deal with it. So we have this discussion about state plus mechanisms, because most of the time, it's your local societies, your NGOs that help make this displaced population more welcome. But when it comes to cross-border displacement, that is a problem. And this is why I think one of the best things that has happened in the, at least at the international level, is this Global Compact of Migration, which actually now thinks talks about what to deal with climate-induced displaced population. And countries are, you know, are they actually prepared to deal with this? You're talking about, for example, the displaced population from Bangladesh going into the neighboring India. I mean, migration is an issue, and it continues to be. There are a lot of things attached to it. And much as you can argue that this displaced population have their own skills, that they can actually contribute to the economy, one has to, you know, as part of this is where regional mechanisms are important, because you have to get the region prepared to think about the possibility of accepting and helping this this displaced population. And you can imagine in a region where, you know, the bilateral it's basically characterized by very difficult bilateral tensions, India and Bangladesh and India and Pakistan. And we're talking about, by the way, as a result of melting, glaciers and all that, in the Hindu Kush region, for example. I mean, you're talking about the possibility of these regions really becoming water stressed. Now, as this actually have implications on Southeast Asia, particularly when it comes to the Mekong, and you have big, we have China as a major player, and, you know, what about the impact of the possibility of even thinking about sharing water resources as a result of, you know, reduced water supply? And that is a major issue that is being, sometimes is swept under the carpet at the multilateral discussion, but is an issue that I think the countries have to be prepared, and how to deal with a big neighbor like China, and getting them to play the role if they want to be seen to be a responsible player in the region, and all this talk about providing public goods, and that one thing that they really have to remember. Thank you.
Well, we're fortunate to have such a wide range of expertise on the stage. We're out of time, but thank you, and please join me in thanking our panelists.
Tall guys who aren't wearing skirts just pop right up onto the stage. It's so much easier for y'all. So I'd like to say thank you to our first panel, thank you to the keynote, our sponsors, and certainly all of you for coming out here on a truly yucky day. So we appreciate your presence today. So in the second panel, we'll focus a bit more on how to respond to the climate challenge. Although, as we heard in the previous panel, talking about, you know, the problem that is here and how to respond to it are pretty much inextricably linked. In the previous panel, we heard how Asia is particularly vulnerable to global change. Parts of Asia, this is really an existential challenge. But Asia is looking to be the engine of economic growth going forward, but that could also make Asia the engine of going forward climate change contributions, which is not a position that that region has been in the past. So there's a lot of different interesting things for this panel to discuss, and I'm looking forward to hearing from us. So our first speaker is Dr. Rod Schoonover. He's the founder and principal of Ecological Futures Group. He's also a former high-level official in the U.S. Intelligence Committee and a former professor at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, a wonderful town. Our next speaker is Brigadier General Joel Vowell. He's Deputy J5 at the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command in the U.S. Army, and he is also a former Federal Executive Fellow here at Brookings, and we're really grateful to have him back today. And on the far side of the stage, our final speaker will be Dr. Hiroshi Ota. He's a professor at the School of International Liberal Studies at Waseda University. So, Rod, I'll give the stage to you for your opening comments.
Thank you, and thank you for coming out on, as was mentioned, a yucky day. I don't know if it's still raining and sleeting, but it was when I walked in. And thanks to Brookings for hosting this event. So normally I'm on the first panel, which is bringing the bad news, and especially being a former U.S. intelligence officer, that's a comfortable place to be. And so I think the first panel did a really excellent job on describing the national security overtones of climate change. I would mention, just for people who are walking in, security really spans human security, national security, and global security, and sometimes those are intermingled. I also think it's important that we take note of some things that aren't always seen as climate change effects and really call them out as such. For example, the things that aren't normally captured in a meteorological framework. So, for example, rise in animal and plant extinctions, redistribution of plant and animal life on Earth, especially in the marine systems that are important to the Asia-Pacific, desynchronization of ecological processes that may have economic effects. Certainly, the risk of an overexpression of rapidly evolving or rapidly reproducing species such as algae. Algal blooms are a giant problem developing, especially where temperatures are already high. And of course, we just heard in the last panel about the Tibetan Plateau. There's a whole range of mountain phenomena such as slope instability and glacial lake outbursts that should rightly be seen as climate effects. And I'm even going to pull back the aperture just a little bit more because if we're pivoting towards looking at solution spaces, we need to talk more than just climate change. So, for example, I'm a scientist by training, so I tend to think of things in a scientific framework. If you pull the camera back, climate change is one of multiple anthropogenic stressors to the planet. So in addition to changing the chemical composition of the atmosphere that leads to greenhouse gas effect and ocean acidification, we're also loading it with aerosols that have an adverse effect on human health. And we're disrupting geochemical cycles such as nitrogen and phosphorus. Nitrogen, for example, leading to nitrogen overloading in the oceans that leads to eutrophication, leads to hypoxia. Land system changes such as deforestation, especially in the Pacific context, mangrove clearing, is very impactful. And then there's a whole set of ocean stresses, as I mentioned before, acidification, there's stratification, there's pollution, there's debris that, and also freshwater stress from overpumping of groundwater and also infrastructure development like dams. I bring these up because if you're looking at what to do in the 20, 30 years where you can bend the trajectory by greenhouse gas emission reduction policies, you have to really look at vulnerability and you have to look at adaptation. And working on those other more direct, less lag time anthropogenic stressors gives you a way to reduce the vulnerability. And there's also a whole set of other social and political stresses that are affecting not just Asia, but the world, income disparity, governance challenges, misinformation and disinformation. And I think it's important to see these holistically because, if you're going to tackle vulnerability and increase the ability for humans to successfully adapt to what are increasingly certain trends in temperature and precipitation changes, then I think you have to look outside of the traditional, certainly the greenhouse gas emission reduction policy, which is crucially important, but there are other parts important too.
That was terrific. You know, I think I'll ask you a follow-on question now before we move on down the line. I really appreciate your focus on multiple natural systems and how these systems can really compound the problem of climate change. Of the kinds of effects that you've described, which of those do you find most important in the Indo-Pacific region, and particularly coastal and island areas?
That's a hard question because Asia is so big. Certainly, if you are looking at Indonesia, biosphere instability is a serious issue. But just more broadly, I really worry about ocean stress. And really, it's not just one. It's the multiplicity of stresses, right? It's not just the acidification from the absorption of carbon dioxide, and it's not just the stratification and the freshification, if that's a word, from melting ice. It's also the direct pollution, the pharmaceuticals that mimic endocrine action in organisms. Microplastics. Again, this is not a word that you normally hear in a national security conversation. Why is that? I don't know, but we just never really talk about something that has such a critical effect on the fisheries on which so many people in Asia depend. So it seems to me that these the suite of stresses on the ocean on which we have very little levers, right? I mean, I'll bring the bad news. There's so little we can do to offset temperature changes in the ocean since it has taken on so much of the thermal spillover from global warming. And so I think that's one of the things that worries me. We don't, we can address illegal fishing, we can address pollution, we can address some of these, some of these other more direct anthropogenic stresses, but I do worry about acidification. I do worry about stratification and changing circulation patterns.
Thank you. Although it's a difficult message to hear that our challenges with the ocean don't just stop at, sea level rise and direct climate effects. So General Val, I'd like to pass it off to you.
Well, thanks. To Brookings in general, as a recidivist repeat offender who's here from 16 to 17, I learned from a lot of national treasures here, so it's always a pleasure to come back and participate. I'm a 28-year Army officer now at the Indo-Pacific Command, WJ-5, for strategic planning and policy. And you might be kind of curious, why would an active duty officer be up here talking about climate change impacts? Well, I will tell you, using an old Soviet maxim, you may not be interested in climate change, but climate change is interested in you. So let me talk strategically about the region, if I may, because it's going to tie together with, I think our panel is really focused on what kind of what's happening now, but what we can do or think about for the future. And I think at Indo-Pacific Command, we deal with some of these all the time. So in the National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, we talk about five stated threats to vital national security: Russia, DPRK, China, violent extremist organizations, and Iran. In our command, four of those five exist every day. Three of those five are nuclear and not in a good way. Two of those five are existential threats to the United States of America and our allies, just in the nuclear arsenal alone. So I think about that a lot. But also stated in those documents are the disasters. We live in a region where 80% of the world's volcanoes and earthquakes happen. Yesterday in the Philippines, 6.8 magnitude earthquake hit the Philippines. This happens every day in the region. Typhoons, other disasters that have been talked about in consequence management from the eloquent speakers before me, happens all the time. So we're kind of, I would say, practiced in consequence management, disaster response, and humanitarian assistance in the region. We get better every day. But that's some of the stuff that we see. So I mentioned PRC, a competitor, geostrategic competitor to the global world order. Make no mistake. Make no mistake about that. But they're also affected by climate change. You saw the statistics that most of the people in their country live on the eastern seaboard of their own country and are also going to be affected in the near term by rising sea levels. But here's what I see when I go forward and talk to different military counterparts, whether it was in the Maldives or in other island nations. In that first island chain in the Pacific, you know, from Japan down through the Philippines and down to Indonesia, Straits of Malacca, that first island chain, they'll tell you what I just told you. Their threats are a competition with China and their pernicious influence that they're trying to achieve. When you get up to the second island chain, to the COFA states, the CNMI, and to the Vanuatus and the Tuvalu and Fiji and Tonga and et cetera, those island nations as described that have their highest point 7 to 10 feet above water, they think it's fascinating that we have this competition right now with China. What really fascinates them is they won't exist in 10, 20, 30 years. And they tell us, in all seriousness, like, we have a challenge. And then you go to a chief of defense conference, which I was at in August of this year in Bangkok. And the chief of defense for Papua New Guinea says this is an issue for his country. Not that his country is directly being affected so much, but they are receiving in receipt of climate change migrants. And they're having to deal with that effect. And so you've got this spectrum now of the, I guess, the acknowledgement of the impacts that are happening in the region. So what do we do in Indo-Pacific Command and the DoD writ large? I mentioned there's been a lot of activity for years because the region has been just prone to that for eons and epochs. But with the advent of more climate change impacts, the more we do with disaster management, the more we do with HADR exercises for interoperability, cooperation, knowledge sharing, and capacity building, the better off we are. You may be surprised in the audience that we exercise with the People's Republic of China's Army, Navy, and Air Force a couple times a year. It's not combat operations we practice. It's humanitarian assistance, disaster response, and disaster management. That is a common challenge to all. It's also a good way to continue collaborative discussion and dialogue and make sure human safety and security is met the best we can. My department deals a lot with consequence management, less proactive mitigation policies. That's up for other instruments of power. I'm but one in the military. There's diplomatic, information, economic, legal, etc. Those policies have to be put in place and what specifically to do. But I will tell you, it's affecting my partners, my allies, when we go talk about security in the region. Here's a last little vignette for you, and I'll pass off the mic. So is the audience aware, about 2-3 weeks ago, tiny little island nation of Tuvalu turned away $400 million from the PRC? Do you know what the PRC was going to do with that money? build them abatements and offshore jetties to make sure the rising sea levels could keep that at bay from the islands themselves. So think about this. I just talked about an existential threat to these island nations that have a very small height that one good tidal wave might take them off the map. And they turned away an offer of aid. I will tell you there's going to be more stories like that going in the future, because with the PRC, there's always some sort of string attached. So there's a country that understands the values of what the PRC is bringing, which are not necessarily good, and they come with those strings, but they still have that problem. We've got to be able to address that in the future. We find common values in allies and partners in ways that our competitors can't, for a liberal, open international order and a free and open Indo-Pacific. But that also requires us to be responsive to their needs in new ways that, from a security standpoint, 28-half-year veteran who's focused on killing bad guys and their stuff to keep us safe and secure, we have to think about those in different ways. And with that, I will yield.
I'm not going to let you give the mic back just yet. I hear a couple of different stories coming about with respect to probably our biggest geostrategic challenge, which is China. On the one hand, you're talking about some things that they're trying to do geopolitically to help the small island states. But on the other hand, there are these bits of cooperation in terms of dealing with disaster response. Could climate change slightly open the door to greater cooperation between us and our greatest geostrategic partner? Or is this likely to become another area where we have challenges and are more at odds? Am I being too positive, or is there a slight sunny spot in here?
Again, I'm a general officer, not a specific officer, so I'm generally knowledgeable on subjects and not very specific. So otherwise, I'd be known as a specific officer. Let me answer the question. I think it's both. So look at the thing we talked about, the Arctic, earlier and at lunch. One of the biggest challenges to China's attempt to go into the Arctic is they have to compete with Russia, who claims it as their own. And that's an interesting geopolitical discussion, where China you don't think of as a member of the Arctic Council, because they're not. They want to be. And why is that? Resource exploitation, resource exploitation, resource exploitation. That's it, kids. So that creates its own challenge. That is an effect of climate change, the receding ice and the open passageways that are going to, we all think, are coming and are being seen now, is going to create that space. That is going to be an interesting place to actually work with other partners, allies, and competitors when those things happen. But you also mentioned impacts to humanity, and I think that is an opportunity for everyone in the region to come together. Again, our strategy, our policy is great power competition, not great power hatred. Okay, this is not about denying China everything on a strategic national level scale. That's not it. I'm not here to tell you that. Our government wants a China that rises in the safe, rules-based order that we allowed them to grow in for the last 40-plus years. That's what we want. So there's opportunity in space. I'm optimistic as well, not naive. I'm optimistic that those wedges and seams could be filled with cooperation. We do that, like I said, those disaster management exchanges. And as I mentioned to the group at lunch today, Operation Cobra Gold exercise every year happens in February in Thailand. There's 28 nations this year. India and PRC were observer nations this year. They're going to participate this February. They're participating in the humanitarian assistance disaster response exercise. Why? Because we want to remain interoperable, even with people we compete with, if that makes sense.
Thanks for that. And I'm always looking for whatever little cracks of light come through on an issue like this. Dr. Ota, the stage is yours, and your slides are here.
I can see the slides, but not. Oh, yeah, here comes. My name is Hiroshi Ota, and came from Japan, and also want to be a part of good ally partner with the United States. And also, coming from the Asia countries, Japan is also very vulnerable countries. I'd like to show first two slides how Japan is vulnerable. Yeah, this is from IPCC's most current fifth assessment report. And Japan, in absolute term and relative term, is the most vulnerable. Yeah? And this is kind of a year from 1998 to 2009, and then most vulnerable or most hit by the extreme weathers, and then most damages in absolute term, meaning that exposures of populations to the extreme weather, over 30 million people, just followed by Philippines, China, India, and most of them are Asian countries. But for the relative term, it's mostly Pacific Island nations. This is quite interesting. And again, for absolute term in economic loss for the GDPs, Japan is number one, and then followed by China and Korea. This is because of the economic size. But again, relative size, most of them are Pacific Islanders. So this is quite interesting how kind of significant or how vulnerable the Pacific Island countries, and also how vulnerable Japan in terms of physically population size affected and also economic damages. And again, this is the most current, the so-called Global Climate Risk Index. This is German Watch NGO group. Again, Japan is the number one. This is an annual base. So last year, we had a major typhoon hit major city in Osaka. So lots of damages. So in terms of the death toll, and then death per 100,000 people, and absolute loss and relative loss, Japan is ranking very high, so becoming number one, and then followed by Philippines and Germany. So this is the quite vulnerable situation in Japan, facing lots of typhoons coming hit now. Even this year, Tokyo hit quite hard area typhoons. But and kind of an interesting question, but puzzling. Not so many major ministries, governmental branches are concerning about climate change as a threat, not even using the climate securities. Only the environment ministries use the climate securities and issued a particular report on climate securities, but not for the Minister of Foreign Affairs, not the Department of Defense. Partly because they do not want to use securities, because it's a very sensitive term in Japan, and particularly for defense forces, self-defense forces. We don't say defense forces. Self-defense forces now, main mission is disaster relief at home. Maybe that will be happier for the Koreans and Chinese people, providing some secure sense of security to the neighboring countries. But anyway, so maybe Dr. Goodman should go to the Japanese defense ministry to lecture how this climate change and security should be connected. But anyway, so there's no so interesting, but they try to be very much disaster relief activities is very important for their missions. So that the most of the ministries and the government think the Japanese international cooperation agencies can play a major role in terms of addressing global climate change in the sense of providing the mitigation policies and adaptation policies. So these are the kind of one example, and I'm not going in detail, but Japan International Cooperation Agency, JICA, the year 2017, spending 787 billion, which is about 7.1 billion US dollars, and then for mitigation and adaptations. These are some concrete the projects, and also 14 countries for the Asian countries, and then 6 countries in the Pacific regions, they're providing some kind of mitigation adaptation, the kind of the assistance. So one of the priorities is promoting low carbon societies, and then resilience buildings and urban development. And another priority is kind of enhancing the countermeasures and also supporting climate policy and institutional development, and also addressing the ecosystem preservations and working with international organizations. So this is quite a low profile, but this is maybe Japanese government is trying to address the problem of climate change. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And I'd like to ask you, I think we sometimes forget, Japan is definitely not a small island nation, it's the largest economy in the region, but there's certainly an island nation nonetheless. Are there lessons that the island nations in the Pacific can learn from Japan's response to climate change?
Yes, I think we don't see the climate change as a major threat, but maybe every year we're facing lots of extreme weathers recently. So we have kind of a preparedness plan, how to prepare, and then providing early warning. So before a typhoon hits or hurricane hits, and government and also local government is sending the warning messages. And even local police and also local township member door to door, and then helping to elderly and disabled people to be able to escape. But still, major floods and coming recently, and then we still lose some lives. But still, try to be, you know, be ready. And also, not only typhoon or extreme weather, but as you know, earthquakes is a major problem. So recently, the public broadcasting in Japanese NHK kind of had a one-week series of the how to prepare when major earthquake hit Tokyo area, mega cities. So there's a kind of a showing us very disastrous scenes. And then for 10 days, there's no supply of water, electricity, how to survive. So those kind of things coming up nowadays, even for the flooding and typhoons. But unfortunately, it's not enough. Still, we're losing lots of money. I just saw that quite a large economic losses and also human illness.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that Japan has quite a bit of experience in disaster response. Yeah, useful, but not the kind of experience you necessarily want to have. So I'd like to start the Q&A period overall by posing a question to all of our panelists. You all come from slightly different positions, which could make this an interesting question for you each to answer. But I'm curious how the cross-Pacific relationship, the relationship between the United States and Canada, Mexico, across to the Pacific, how that can be leveraged to help Pacific nations, and particularly the less developed Pacific nations, deal with their climate issues? How can we leverage, what can we bring to the table in order to help our friends and allies across the ocean? And I'm open to whatever order you all would like to answer that in.
I'll start. So I just returned from the conference, American Geophysical Union, so I'm going to put on my science hat. Instead of my former intelligence officer hat. I actually think that, and piggybacking on a couple things that have already been mentioned about early warning, I think this is a place where a lot of fruit is left to be picked in terms of not just early warning, forecasting the weather longer into the, or further into the future, but also while I was there, I saw efforts into nascent ecological forecasting, helping to forecast the health of certain critical ecosystems into changing climate conditions. The second largest, the country with the second highest number of attendees was China. They are a critical part of filling in scientific knowledge that's quite specific to Asia. I think a lot of researchers bring a flavor of their own country or their own region into their own research. Japan was another very large attendee, so was Thailand. I think the science to science linkage, especially if it is, the word goose came into my mind. If it's goosed by governments, maybe it's lubricated. Is that the right word?
Sure.
Okay.
encouraged.
Encouraged. Thank you.
Nurtured.
I think can bear a lot of fruit. And so, I think there's so much dividend, there's so many dividends from this ecological forecasting, maybe even dipping into sociological forecasting. If we can get a handle on migration patterns well before they're established, that would be a real benefit to the security and policy world.
Yeah, just a couple of adds that while I was thinking about the question, again, not a subject matter expert by any stretch of the imagination, but there are a couple fora that exist where there are opportunities. One's ASEAN, and the subcommittees really for ASEAN that would probably be best addressed. Multiple nations involved, but that's aspirational. We have challenges in ASEAN, in my opinion, with just things like the code of conduct for the South China Seas, where UNCLOS is going, where recommendations are going. But there's also the Pacific Islands Forum, so the PIF is another opportunity. There's several, there's about four dialogues with Pacific Island nations throughout the year that have different countries involved, some from East Asia, some from North and Latin America. So I think those are venues to have the dialogue discussion going forward about what to do. The last thing I'll leave is what was impressive to me in this last assignment and now this one is just how involved academia and other institutions and NGOs, PBOs are involved in the region in ways I didn't know. So, for example, University of Hawaii has a huge outreach program across the region. As an example, and there are many others, that just from a common operational picture of operations, activities, and influence across institutions, they and others, University in Australia, Sydney is involved, and some others in what we call the Lower Pacific, they would call Northern Pacific, to have this dialogue and discussion for mitigation and response. We specifically get involved in building partner capacity with things like maritime domain awareness, with sonobuoys, with equipment to help primarily those Pacific Island nations deal with the IUU, you know, illegal, unregulated, and unreporting fishing issues, and also just to maintain their economic exclusive zones outside their 200 nautical miles. But that's a venue as well to make sure we can bring those issues up. Other than that, I don't have any better policy prescriptions.
I'm not representing the Japanese government, so I'd like to speak for the people-to-people relationship. I think Japan and Korea should cooperate more, and because in ASEAN Plus 3 and also Pacific Island Forum, I think Japan can, and also together with Korea, can really become effective, facilitators to promote all this international cooperation. It's very difficult to work with China, as JP mentioned, but quite competitive, strategically competitive. But unfortunately, today is not so, government relationship between two countries is not so positive and very negative. But I think for the future, talking about North Korea's issues and climate change issues, and particularly energy transition, we should have some kind of international transmission network with Korea and Japan and Taiwan. That will be helpful to address mitigation and also maybe help for adaptation. So I think confidence buildings is quite important, I guess. First, we should kind of how to build trust among the neighboring countries. I think this is fundamentally very important to me. And then we can further work on the climate change issues. So this is my kind of take.
Thank you. I think it's probably a good time to open it up for questions. In fact, I see people jumping the gun and raising their hands. So let's get the mics out there. There's a question right here from this gentleman in the third row. And I'd like to take three of them, and then we can pose them across the row. You can choose what to answer or not.
Thank you. I'm Piotr, thematic specialist with Amnesty. My question was initially going to be towards the ambassador, but perhaps it's better suited here. Something that's obviously, as one of the younger generational people, we've got Greta, and is the idea of, grassroots initiatives. But my question simply is, what do you think the role of social media is? And also, sub-question but related is, unfortunately, the UK decided to re-vote in a rather populist leader, and he represents a few other leaders around the world, such as Bolsonaro, who are heavily influential in how much we can actually produce national strategies to mitigate or adapt to climate change. And I just want to hear what you think we can do to respond to climate change with the idea of populism as a barrier. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Steve Winters, independent consultant. Since we have a voice from Japan here, I'd like to see if you could clarify something I've heard. But my understanding is that it's either the southernmost or maybe the southeasternmost point of territory, the Japanese territory, is a little speck in the water, which is sort of sinking under the water. And if it disappears completely, then this issue of what is the you know, the economic zone and so forth, and afterwards. And so this issue also arises for major powers. And actually, an international lawyer from Singapore said to me once, and this is probably not the case, but I like your idea on it if you have one. He said, you know, one of the reasons that you don't hear Japan criticizing China for its artificial features that they're building in the South China Sea is because Japan, in a sense, is pouring all this concrete on their little place, and it's going to end up to be an artificial feature. But they want to continue to have it to count.
I'm Lucy Mines with the Asia Bureau at USAID. And I'm curious how you think about the competing need. Asia is meant to be an economic engine. Economic engines are based on consumerism. Consumerism has a significant impact on climate change, as does urbanization, which is also a major factor in Asia. So with you, if you have those forces, how can you work around them to address some of the issues that you've already raised about the climate change impact?
Thank you so much. We have three great questions. One about how to deal with climate change in a world that's becoming more populist. One, and let's expand it not to just Japan's maritime boundary, but as islands are perhaps sinking, how will we think about maritime boundaries in the future? And then one of how do you combine Asia as an economic engine and the economic growth and perhaps increase in climate emissions that that involves? And so you can answer as many or as few as you'd like, but I'll just start it down the row. Should I start at the other end to change things up a little bit?
Yeah.
Would you like to begin?
Three of them is quite difficult questions to answer. For the territorial issues, the small island, Minami no Torishima, is one of the islands you mentioned, maybe. Government is building up the concretizing the island, not kind of avoiding to become submerged into the sea. So, of course, the EZ is one of the most concerned. And then not only island territory, but also fishing ground surrounding this. So economically and strategically, very important to maintain this island. So I think Japanese government tried to striving for the maintaining this island. But not only, not because of this island issues, Japan is not kind of taking a strong stance against Chinese expansion of the South Side in China Sea, and maybe different issue, I guess, different dimension. But certainly, this very much concerned about this. Japan's government is very much concerned about territorial issues with regard to the climate change. The question about populism and how to kind of raise awareness and also try to mitigate climate change is also a very difficult problem. But just maybe introducing a very small concrete example how to kind of deal with is that economic matter is quite important. And for example, Japanese government has been criticized by the international communities still maintaining coal power plants projects, even try to build new ones. But international financial institutions like institutional investors, even Norwegian institutional investors divesting money from the coal power plants related companies' activities. So in this way, not directly addressing populism, but in this way, maybe kind of economic incentive, disincentive can change the behaviors. So I think somehow addressing more the immediate short-term interest to thinking about the long-term solution of climate change may be one of the approach to deal with this kind of a rise of populism. Yet we can pursue the mitigation policies. And the engine of Asia as an economic engine, and then how to address urbanizations is quite a fundamental question to, I think, not only Asian countries, but also other American continents and others. But I think one of the broad answers to your question is sustainable societies is one, sustainable community buildings. And also, maybe younger generations is not necessarily for the older generations kind of pursuing the material wealth. So they are more kind of economics and then also not pursuing the material wealth, but also more qualitative quality of life they are pursuing. So maybe lifestyle changings, and then many urban dwellers in Japan feeling tremendous fear of when we have major disasters. So maybe they are thinking about going to the local areas and maybe changing the urbanization plan to the more kind of a compact city type of cities. We can have public transportations, and everything is walking distance. Those kind of maybe new urbanization plan should be one of the way to change the urgent problem of we're facing today. But not so overnight solutions we can provide for you.
Okay, I'm going to try to go real quickly to the gentleman up front. I'm an instrument of national policy. I won't get into politics. But I will say this, I'm a little more optimistic, and it comes down to education. I'm a child of the 1970s and 80s public school education in America, very different from my father's generation when we grew up in the conservation movement. Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, et cetera, et cetera. I grew up with that. So it's ingrained in me to personally, and my generation in the military as well have got this in our DNA, that we just don't throw oil down the drain and we actually try to treat the environment a little bit with some respect. Much more than we did before, not good enough. I've got a 21-year-old and an 18-year-old. They're screenagers. They have to have a screen in front of them. They communicate through social media. They do, but that is extremely impactful. And it's a mobilization for mass movement, if you will. My fear is that you've got to have the right education platform to do that. I say fear. My concern is. There's a lot of easy ways to disinform society that way or gravitate to what you think is your preconceived notion for something, and that's all I'll say about that. But I'm not pessimistic about which leadership of which country now is going to stop all movement. I look at my sons who, I do want to leave it better than I found it for them, but they're not waiting. And I think that's your generation. You look like you're under 30. So I think they're going to move out on that. I think they're going to surprise us. I'm optimistic that way. Artificial features. Let me counter a couple things here. There is a vast difference between the dubious territorial claims by the PRC in the South China Seas, the Spratlys and the Paracels, Fiery Cross, Mischief Reef. 2016 Court of Arbitration for UNCLOS found in favor of the Philippines. Who listened? Not the PRC. They don't give a damn. That's not their territory. We gave that to, quite frankly, the Republic of China when we supported Chiang Kai-shek, the 9-, now 10-, line. That's territory, not the seas. But as we all know, 200 nautical miles for an exclusive economic zone impacts Malaysia, Brunei, Indonesia, Vietnam, and the PRC, all in the South China Seas, and are all in competition with that space. What Japan is doing is maintaining sovereignty that's not in contest. And territorial integrity, which they should do. That's why nobody's really talking about that. But you go down the street here at CSIS or in this building and show you open source pictures of the militarization of the South China Seas. That is a totally different issue. And while I'm on it, speaking of conservationism and ecological protection, the worst coral disasters and sand plumes in the world are happening with all the construction by China in the South China Seas. They have debrided coral features and ecological systems en masse that are not coming back. just to put airfields and revetments and missiles out in the middle of the ocean. That's a challenge. I have nothing to say on consumerism and urbanization other than I realize that those are true. And so if you have a less materialistic society, sustainable infrastructure, British author named Matthew Ridley talked about this a while ago in a couple books, but he's more the rational optimism about developing societies. I don't know enough to know more than that. I think that that is a factor, and you're absolutely right, and they're in competition with what could be causing climate change.
I'll be quick. A lot of what I had to say was said before. I think the grassroots movement, because that's the first part of your question, can only be seen as a positive thing, especially currently. I do have a concern that if tactics became more militant, that it would be painted as in a different light. And so, and the second part of your question was about social media. And like a lot of things, maybe like most things, maybe like everything, nothing is purely good or purely bad. And social media, you know, in my mind, it's about 50-50 right now. I'm generally very concerned about information integrity. It goes into the education question that was brought up earlier. How do people know what's true? One of my big heroes in science was Carl Sagan, and he talked about science as a candle in the dark. And I think when scientific knowledge, scientific integrity is challenged, not just by social media, but that seems to be a new engine that those of us who have been following climate change for, you know, decades, this is a new thing, or at least a new element. I am worried about that. In terms of competing needs, I don't have much to say on EEZs any more than what you've already heard. But in terms of competing needs, that's a great question. It's a USAID officer would really pick up on that very quickly, because it's a tension that's built in to our modern society. And I actually think that, you know, if you run the 20th century again, knowing what we know now, right, would we optimize a multidimensional problem over one variable? Which means, would you run agriculture so that you maximize your yield without regard to what you're doing to soil? Would you catch as many fish as possible without looking at the long-term integrity? That's kind of what we do. And so I actually don't see urbanization in, and I'm sure you don't either, in a negative light. I actually think it's a cultural engine and a political governance engine that we really need to tap into. But it's also the site of a lot of vulnerabilities that are emerging because we're not updating our infrastructure. We probably need to rethink infrastructure completely. Because if we're building things that are going to allegedly last for 50 to 100 years, that's probably not a strategy when we're not looking at a stability point anytime soon. So we may need to think of resilience and not as opposed to disposability, but circularity. So it's good for, you know, for about 10 years, and then we do it again and do it again. That's the way nature adapts, by little iterations with stress.
Thanks. And I like the question about populism a lot, so I'm actually going to take the moderator's prerogative and say a couple of words too. And we're really seeing a lot of that in the world right now, and it's something I've thought about a lot in my own work. Not just populism, but anti-globalization, anti-multilateralism. We're seeing that happen in a lot of places in the world right now. And the cure isn't the right word, but the antidote to this, I think, is a youth population that really cares. If you're a populist and you're coming out and saying, I want what the people want, and what the people want is climate action, then that's helpful. The anti-globalization is a bit harder to work with, but if you have a constituency that really wants action, that really wants resiliency, that really wants a greener energy system, politicians listen to that. And so I think we go back to, I'm a child of the 70s as well, and the environmental movement was quite different then than it was now. But on the other hand, we were brought up to care about certain things, and then I see younger people today who look at them completely differently and care about them to a completely different degree. They're starting to think about things like circularity and not having a throwaway culture. And we are approaching things differently. And I think as that generation grows up, votes, that will help politicians respond to the people that they represent. So that's an optimistic view, but you got to be optimistic about something. So on that note, I'd like to take some more questions. This gentleman...
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Grayson. So I have a question. So without measurement, we have no management. Without management, we can't have mitigation. So I'm curious what all of your thoughts are on the emergence of technologies such as 5G, AI, supercomputing, GIS technologies, and how these can influence how we study and understand how the environment is changing and how we can use these technologies to address these changes. And if you can give maybe at least one specific example of what you've seen, how these technologies are being used. Thank you.
Thanks. Back here in the back row, and then the gentleman in front of him.
Yes, Emmanuel Pastrage from the Asia Institute. I had a question, and the question of, say, fossil fuels and mitigation, I guess what I was sort of hoping was someone would say, we'll stop using coal and oil by such and such a date. And particularly in the case of the military, which is a relatively controlled economic system, it's actually possible in a way you can't do in other sectors to say, we'll go to electric within 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. And I was curious in terms of what your thoughts were in terms of how, particularly the military, could serve as sort of the vanguard in terms of absolute mitigation. Thank you.
Hi, sorry. My name is William. I'm with the Woodrow Wilson Center. And I had a question for all three of you, I suppose. I just spent the last couple of months in Beijing and all around different parts of China. And one of the things I've noticed there is that, you know, while there is a really, really big effort to, you know, to be switching to renewable energy, to be, you know, increased recycling, there does remain in China and in a number of different countries around Asia and the Pacific a kind of a stigma that, you know, these renewable energy efforts and environmental conscientiousness is kind of a force pushed by Western powers, pushed by industrialized nations onto countries such as China, India, Vietnam, and so on, that, you know, why do these countries get to pollute so much, having already done so, having already industrialized, whereas with countries like China and India, who are now going through the process of their industrialization, now being forced to do it in a very restricting way. So what is there a way around this, and is there a way to promote industrialization and economic growth in these countries that doesn't compromise renewable development? Thank you.
Excellent. Three more good questions. How is new technology influencing our understanding of the environment? Can the military be in the vanguard of moving away from fossil fuels? And is this push for climate action against fossil fuels an imperialist ploy coming from the West? So
I'll just start because I have short answers. I think the tech piece of this is really the only way out. Especially with early warning and forecasting. We're here talking about this because of remote sensing. We would have this problem that we didn't really have a handle on And we would just be vulnerable to all of these climate effects if we didn't have a deep understanding of how the Earth system works. And that is largely from remote sensing. And so, you know, although I do worry about 5G and the overlap between some of the hydrological spectra, I think 5G, and I think especially AI as a interpretive tool in detecting early warning, I think is probably invaluable. Military should decarbonize as quickly as they can. And they should use mill-to-mill engagement to help other militaries decarbonize as quickly as possible. That's the only correct answer, in my opinion. And China and other Asian countries, other developing countries, are unfortunately also some of the most vulnerable. The worldview, climate change is part of the worldview at this point. It's no longer a niche topic when I started looking at it. People are more ready to identify things as climate change. And I actually think some of these effects that happen in Asia will be very quickly seen as climate effects. Now, I don't understand China internal politics well enough to know whether that has any effect on its direction, but I think that's it's an interesting question.
I'll take the technology question from a different angle. We in the department are optimistic about the character and future of conflict changing, and we see that today with machine learning, inroads to artificial intelligence. And if I could just project there, if you try to war game today with a bunch of people in a room and think about action, reaction, counteraction in a scenario, it might take a couple hours to figure out what's the best course of action. What if I could do 10,000 emulations in less than 2 seconds? So if I had that technology capability, bunches of algorithms cross-queuing that could tell me where to be predictive, what best course of action country X could take for a climate change abatement, et cetera, that might be helpful. It would also be apolitical, I'd offer. Alternative fuels, you might be surprised. I know I speak from the Army's side. There's other investments in the other services, but there's an assistant secretary of the Army for installations, environment, and energy, IE&E. And their charge is to do – I don't know the goals. I would be lying if I told you percentages, but their goals are to reduce those kind of carbon footprint emissions. So there's a lot of solarization on installations across CONUS specifically. If you go to Fort Knox, Kentucky, if you go out to Fort Bliss, if you go to Fort Campbell, there are solar fields that didn't exist 5-10 years ago that are starting to replace the energy that's coming from other sources, you know, carbon or other base sources. That's a step in the right direction. We've had a nuclear navy for a while, so that's been helpful for decades. And we don't recommend anybody else become nuclear, at least for weapons. I can't speak to the stigma. I would just say that if I understood the question correctly, I don't get my chance to rise up and industrialize, but you did, and you caused all these problems, then, yeah, I would be kind of pissed about that too, but go ahead.
For the technological question, I think you already heard some answers, but I think I raised one kind of negative aspect of the using of technological development. Japan is very much famous of the energy-efficient technologies. So because of energy efficiency, we use more house appliances, more refrigerators, more the washlet with toilet, special, you know, the features of the using more energies in total. So this is kind of the negative byproduct of the using energy technology, efficient technologies. And for the last question, how to address the industrializations, particularly emerging economies, being able to less environmentally harmful development if possible. I think the two ways, one positive ways of developed countries show to the developing countries is that going to green, and you can provide more opportunities for the job and also new development of the technologies. So now the green is better and also more profitable than all steel and, you know, chemical industries. And also Chinese society is suffering from air pollutions, so that because of domestic pressures, government have to introduce massively renewable. But yet they have to maintain economic growth. They exporting coal power plants to the foreign countries. But if we change the model of the development, so that the positive way of showing that most advanced countries, U.S. and Japan, European countries, show the new lifestyle, so not using plastics, not using big facilities, and then going to the more public transportation systems, and then bicycling and others, and EV cars, and also remodeling the urban setting, like I just said, the smart cities and also compact cities, everything in your hand, kind of reach on the walking distance and this kind of things. And also negatively, we can show you should not imitate us, because kind of a urban setting in Tokyo is terrible in terms of future major disasters. So we have to concern about, you know, we try to disperse the major business and political centers, other cities, but there are lots of the resistance from the Tokyo governors, like Ishihara, former Ishihara governor, try to oppose any kind of relocation as part of the functions of the city. But now, so that we become very vulnerable urban city. So China is kind of learning from the mistake of Japan, I guess. So maybe some other countries, India also can learn the major concentration of economic, political, you know, facilities in Tokyo is a most vulnerable, you know, environment we're creating. So I think negatively we can show showing that other emerging economies do not imitate Japan. So this is another way, kind of showing this the previous industrialization model is not working for the sustainable societies.
Well, I'd like to wrap up by saying that I really feel like we've had three panelists here with very disparate backgrounds, but I feel like we've turned into more than the sum of our parts, and so I'm very grateful for that. I'd also like to point out that we've really talked all day today about the fact that Asia may have the most to lose in terms of dealing with climate. There are a lot of states there that are very vulnerable. But there's also a lot of opportunities for cooperation here, not just on technologies that work, but also on kind of the soft infrastructure of climate change, on policies, on education systems, on the kind of things that can really help us move the needle on the climate. So I'd like you to join me in thanking our panelists, and we thank you for coming out today.